And
say Wazza. Come on, get Australian about it.
Wazza.
Wazza.
Wazza. Wazza channels the old Dutcho, doesn't she? You know? And then
hi, I'm Elizabeth Flux.
I'm Ben McKenzie.
Welcome to Pratchett, the monthly Terry Pratchett Book Club podcast.
Each month, we discuss one of Terry Pratchett's books with a special guest.
This month, we're getting down to business and we're reading Monstrous Regiment. That was a Mulan joke.
And our guest is New Zealand writer and performer Freya Daly-Sadgrove. Welcome, Freya.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
For the record, I waved. It's been like 6 years of this podcast and I've forgotten to do audio.
Well, it's just for a podcast about books, we are sometimes surprisingly visual. That's okay. Freya, it's a real pleasure to have you here. You've read this book before and you've read several Terry Pratchett books. Am I right in thinking that? How did you get into Terry Pratchett and the Discworld?
So I haven't read several in proportion to how many books Terry Pratchett has written. I started with Tiffany Aiken, and I started as an adult, thanks to a dude, which sometimes is how I get into, dude stuff. I feel like Terry's, you know, a dude. I don't know. I wasn't ready for Terry as a child, I don't think, because I wasn't mature enough to accept his covers, which offended my girlish sensibilities. But now I'm a grown up and I contain multitudes. And yeah, I met this boy who was like one kind man amongst hordes of ones who wouldn't have introduced me to Terry Pratchett, if you know what I mean. So he was like, I think you're really gonna love this, because I really love Diana Wynne Jones.
Yes.
And sort of children's fiction generally, and like Diana is my hero. So I kind of got him to read a bunch of Diana and he got me to read Terry. And I love Tiffany Aching. I think she was the perfect avenue in for me. I can't remember what order Monstrous Regiment came, but I think it was the first one I read after Tiffany Aching. So like, I didn't even really know Vimes or anyone. So it was quite an it was really cool to reread this. I had a really reready experience, because obviously it's so, once you've read it, you know the thing about it. So yeah, it was really nice to come back now and read it. Like, must be like, can't be 10 years ago that I read it first, but I don't know. I really love a reread. I'm a big rereader. So my favorite book I've read about 15 times, and I definitely feel like I could read this one lots more times and still get more out of
it. So what is that book?
Yeah, we can't let that comment go past. What is your favorite book?
Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh my God. So I was going to say Howl's Moving Castle is one of the ones that I've read the most times. Well, not 15, but it is very rereadable, and there's things that you don't understand in the first few reads and you're like, oh, they're jeans. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
Oh.
They're freaked you. They're wearing jeans. Yeah, man. There's more every time. In fact, I've actually probably read it more than 15 times, because I first read it when I was 8 and I'm now 31. And there's definitely been, usually I read it once a year. So actually that's many times. I'm not doing that.
That's heaps. That's great.
But I reread Diana Wynne Jones a lot. Howl's Moving Castle. What a beautiful work. And she shares something with Terry Pratchett. I don't know. They're not similar to me, but they share I don't know. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They feel like
they're symbiotic.
So were they friends?
I think they knew each other.
Yeah, we've wondered about this on the podcast before. They definitely did know each other. I don't know if they corresponded or anything, but we found a panel like from some sci-fi event in the 80s that both of them were on talking about fantasy stories, chaired by Neil Gaiman. So it was pretty amazing find. So I'll send you that link. Well, I'll put it in the episode notes as well. But also, I think they definitely spoke. Yeah.
Mm.
And there's a certain sensibility that they seem to have in.
Yeah. The questions that seem to go through their work. I don't know. There's definitely parallels.
And the humor of it as well.
Yeah, it's totally. And like a bit of silliness.
Yeah.
Terry's sillier, I think.
And they both write stories that are kind of about stories in ways as well. Like How's Moving Castle is very much fully, like a meta commentary on, you know, fairy tales and stuff. It's so good. And there's a lot of stuff like that in Pratchett too.
I love it so much.
And Homeward Bounders, like that wouldn't seem out of place, like in, like just slotted into the Discworld somewhere. Like,
yeah, fully. Ah, big worlds. They got big worlds. I think I really love that about Terry Pratchett, and I need to read more of Discworld. Rereading this has made me be like, oh, I'm going to have another phase. I'm going to read a lot of Terry Pratchett now. So my friend who lent me this one has lent me a bunch of others. I'm going to get into the big witches.
This is just to say that since rereading and deeply enjoying Monstrous Regiment, my Terry Pratchett fire has been rekindled in a big way. I read a couple of witches books that I hadn't read before, and I adore those ladies. I love them so much. I read Carpe Jugulum and Lords and Ladies, and I just had a beautiful time. And then I read Thief of Time, speaking of beautiful time, and it blew my mind. It blew my goddamn mind. It was incredible. And I know that I will read them again, and I feel like I'm at the perfect time in my life. I need something that is as nuanced and incisive and real about human nature, as well as being this fucking silly and also this life affirming. It's really what I need right now, and so I will be continuing a massive hoon on Discworld, and I just wanted to say thank you for that, because it's going down a goddamn treat.
The witches are a joy. I did not initially like love the witches series when I first read through it. I was like, oh, this is fine. But now I absolutely cannot get enough of them. So this whole podcast has been a rereading like joy. Sometimes it's the first time I've read a book, but often you're like, okay, well, I wouldn't have reread that one. And now you're like, oh, I'm glad I got the chance to actually realize that I love that book. So
hell yeah.
Mm.
Such a good feeling.
Look, I'm sure we'll get into this, but I had that experience with this book. I did not remember it that well. Like I remember the plot. Mm. I kind of vaguely remember what happened.
And the thing.
But my memory of it was quite different to the real thing. yes, and I did know I remembered the thing about the book. But but we'll get to that. We'll get to that, I'm sure.
But beyond the thing, like I had a similar thing. Not the thing, but when I was trying to remember this book before getting back into it, I only remembered one scene, and it's the one where Otto, the photographer, shows up, takes a photo and explodes. And I was like, that's the only thing I could remember out of the book other than the thing. But that scene just vividly burned into my memory. It was
wow.
But it all comes back as you're going. Like you're like, you know, like you can see the step in front of you, like, oh, here we go. Oh, it's this, there we go.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's a big book, so we should probably get into it.
Is it? How many pages is it? Like 400?
Nearly 500.
Oh, no, almost 500 pages long. Great.
I mean, it's not his longest novel, but it's up there. It's up there.
That's silly.
Yeah.
But we should kick this off, as we traditionally do, with a reading of the blurb. It began as a sudden strange fancy. Polly Perks had to become a boy in a hurry. Cutting off her hair and wearing trousers was easy. Learning to fart and belch in public and walk like an ape took more time. And now she's enlisted in the army and is searching for her lost brother. But there's a war on. There's always a war on. And Polly and her fellow recruits are suddenly in the thick of it, without any training, and the enemy is hunting them. All they have on their side is the most artful sergeant in the army and a vampire with a lust for coffee. Well, they have the secret. And as they take the war to the heart of the enemy, they have to use all the resources of the Monstrous Regiment. Dun, 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 dun. It's a good blurb, actually.
It's a sick blurb. And also the little quotes on there. Spot on.
Yeah. Which ones have you got? I've got one from the Daily Express.
Same.
Oh, yeah. And the Times.
Yeah.
We've got the same copy.
A great piece of writing akin to Jonathan Swift. I mean, holy moly.
Well, I haven't got that. I've got, not since Evelyn Waugh has conflict faced such thorough cutting questioning.
Ooh. Mine's got that. And then the Jonathan Swift thing. So it's a double whammy. Oh, wow.
But my blurb also starts with, women belong in the kitchen. Everyone knows that. Not in jobs, pubs, or indeed trousers, and certainly not in the front line.
Oh,
my God.
That is pretty funny, though. Certainly not in trousers. Which, now, this might become relevant later on when we get to the questions. We all have an Australian edition of the book, and that might become important later on. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Yes, I saw some tantalizing DMs that you were having, and I was like, oh, he's going to say something on the podcast. He's going to say something interesting and specific, but no spoilers.
Well, it may not have got that far, but let's not tease that anymore. Let's get into the plot of the book, because it's a long book. We've got to get through it. But we do start, and the book does open as advertised, with Polly becoming a boy in a hurry as she cuts her hair off. We're straight into it. You know, there's no preamble. It's not like the first, however.
Let's get down to business.
Part of Mulan where we're waiting for it to happen. We're just like straight in there. And this first section of the book, she's cutting off her hair. She's running away to join the army in Borogravia where she lives. It's like the Discworld equivalent of like a tiny Eastern European country, like one that used to be part of the USSR or something. And she's running off to join the army because her brother enlisted, but they haven't heard from him for quite a long time. And she feels kind of responsible and wants to go and find him and make sure he's all right.
Secretly, he's the chosen one on Dune, so. Sorry, his name is Paul.
And he's a sweetie pie.
Oh, he is.
Yeah, he sounds lovely.
He sounds lovely. We don't really ever meet him, but.
No.
But boy, is he. He just gives me such sweetie pie vibes, painting his little birds. He shouldn't be in the army.
No.
No, but he believes the propaganda.
Yeah.
Works on him.
Yeah, I know. He ate it right up. But I'm a real sucker for that kind of big, strong, but soft character. I kind of love that.
Me too.
Yeah, he's like the big guy who bakes bread, Elliot, in Questionable Content.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very specific reference.
No, I remember. But, yeah, she's off to join the army. And the important things that we learn about Borogravia, their leader is a woman named the Duchess, and everyone has a picture of the Duchess in their house, a bit like how in the UK it was the case at one time that everyone had a picture of the Queen. But, you know, she follows you around the room. She's always watching you, and you've got a feeling like, you know, her eyes are on your back because people pray to the Duchess as a way of hopefully getting their prayers heard by their actual god, whose name is Nuggan, who we have met before. Now, I don't know if you've read the book where Nuggan shows up.
I have not.
He's a minor character in a book called The Last Hero, which I've done an episode about that. We'll link to that in the episode notes if you want to go back and listen to it, listener.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, he sort of just appears and someone meets him when he accompanies a bunch of heroes to the home of the gods on the top of the mountain in the middle of the Discworld. And the guy who was from his country, who worshipped him, who's from Borogravia, he's just angry with him. He's like, why did you tell me you couldn't eat chocolate? Like, he was just really angry.
Which is a fair enough question.
Yeah.
So, what was his vibe in that book? Was he also crazy?
He doesn't come across as crazy, but it's an illustrated book. And the illustration of him is of a very small, round, bald man who looks like he's probably a clerk or something, like a really officious, nasty clerk who goes out of his way to make your life difficult.
I love the bit where someone describes him to Vines as a god who would write letters to the editor. A technique. Oh, so good.
That was so great. Vibe. Yeah. Yeah, so Nuggan's a piece of work. And the other thing about him that we learn quite early in the book is that the holy book, the Book of Nuggan, is a living testament, by which they mean he just keeps adding new abominations, things you're not allowed to do or enjoy, into the back of the book, which later in the book, I think they say, like, this is why they know they feel like he's gone mad, because, like, he's starting to add things like the color blue and rocks and jigsaw puzzles.
Ah, Nuggan.
I did like that they kind of justify some of them. Like, he says jigsaw puzzles are not allowed because they break the perfect world into little pieces. And I'm like, Okay, but that's like the point.
Nuggins a poet.
You can justify most things.
Mm, that's true. You can find a justification for anything. But, yeah, we meet Polly when she's in this sort of – she's making a big drastic life decision. We sort of find out as we go from her memories what her life was like before, where she's working as the barmaid in her father's tavern, which is also called the Duchess, and basically running the place because she's the one who knows how to do everything. Because it's been a while since I read it, I didn't remember it that well, but I just – Polly's awesome. She's the best.
Yeah, Polly's a badass.
Yeah, she can do anything.
Yeah.
But at the same time, is this like her first real decision she's ever made in her life? Because she's got that like wary like Nuggin stuff in the back of her mind that she hasn't like believed in him since like she had her experience. Like we can say it now, like when she was young, she saved up to get paints for her sweet older brother who she basically is an elder sister to because he's got talent at painting. He paints a bird that's an abomination unto Nuggin and their mother burns it. And from that point onwards, she's very sus on Nuggin. She's like, I don't really believe in a god who would do something like this and also would kill my mother. Like, it's just so she's had that moment early on, and yet her life is shaped both by this Nuggin religion and the fact that her country is always at war, like always at war. So as a woman, she cannot inherit the pub that she really should get and wants to have. Her only options are to sort of run it quietly while her brother, like, is the front man, which she'd be happy with, or find some chump to marry and have him own it while she runs it. And she really is not on board with that option. She doesn't even entertain it for a second. Mm. And then her brother gets brought in by propaganda. Her dad is gone. Like, what's happened to her father again?
No, he's still around.
He's hanging out with a widow.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. He's having some jolly times with the widow.
He's having some jolly times.
But she's very pragmatic about that. I think this is one of the early things that made me really shine to her, is that she wasn't like, I can't believe my dad is seeing another woman, you know, however
long. She was cool.
Because apparently her mum's been dead for a while at this stage. And she's just like,
stay.
There's that great line where she's like, you know, her mother's death and Paul's long absence had taken a lot out of her father, and she was glad some of it was being put back, you know, from what he was getting out of the relationship. And I'm like, that's great, you know?
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I did feel like she's a bit of a, like, there's some characters that you feel are very much like Pratchett's way of thinking. Like, they think the way he thinks about the situation. I got that feeling with Polly. What did you think about that?
Well, I mean, Pratchett's awesome and Polly's awesome, so I can see that parallel already. But, I mean, since the whole book is a commentary on war is crap, but let's figure that out through a personal lens, a personal story of someone who's not on the side that we normally see these books and these perspectives from, I feel like it is Terry Pratchett talking through a character, but at the same time it's not, because he's sort of, there's a lot of imagination in this because he is sort of going out of his normal book comfort zone. Like, it's not his normal go-to characters. It's not his normal go-to type of character. So, yes, while there's a lot of his opinion in there, and I think he spreads that out through the whole regiment in a lot of ways. I think he was like, what's the most kick-ass woman I can create? Here's Polly, and how will we tell this story of war? And then his opinion is scattered out throughout them.
Can I ask, what is his typical character for you guys with your extensive knowledge, if Polly isn't?
I'd say Vimes is a go-to for him.
Yeah.
Mm.
And he's in there, but he's not the primary. So,
yeah,
like, it would have been more comfortable to make him the primary character.
Yeah.
Maybe, but
I mean, Polly, you know, she's a new character that he's invented just for this book. And interestingly, this was the last of the standalone books that wasn't, you know, part of a series that had other characters. Like, he did invent some new characters after this, most notably Moist von Lipwig, who comes through in Going Postal and the other two books that he's in.
And if you haven't read those, I think you'll like them.
Mm. Yeah.
I would say so too. But I actually, you know, I slightly disagree with you, Liz. I think that Polly is very much the kind of character, or one of the kinds of character, that he really likes to write, because I think she does have some things in common with, say, Tiffany Aching or even Granny Weatherwax. Mm. Like, she's very practical. She's very no-nonsense, and she's very competent, you know? Like, out of all of the people in her regiment, like, she's the one who's really thought about, how do I get away with this thing that I'm doing, like this deception, and really thought, you know, like, she's got the fake razor that she can use so she can pretend to shave. When she leaves to get recruited, she doesn't just go to the recruiters outside her own inn in her own town. Like, she sneaks away to another town over the river so that nobody knows where she's from or recognizes her. Like, she's really thought about it. And that comes through, I think, in most of the book. And it's one of the things that Jackram sees in her later on.
No, I agree with that. Basically, I don't feel like she's an avatar for Pratchett. I think she's absolutely the kind of character that he writes. And I completely agree with that she fits in the mold of like Granny Weatherwax and Tiffany and Susan. But in terms of him being like a character in the book that's like talking through someone else, I don't think that's her. I think she's like an aspirational creation and his voice, his opinions are scattered.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's not long before she meets some of those other characters because she sneaks across the river and gets to the recruiters, who are very important characters in the book as well. So the recruiting sergeant, and look, this is unfortunately a trope that Pratchett, even this late in his career, so this is book 31, if I remember rightly, and it comes in between the first two Tiffany books in terms of the order in which they were written. But even by this stage, he's still, like, he's very careful, like, he's really learned to embrace all kinds of people and not, like, you know, reject anyone and nobody's evil. So, but he just cannot stop making fat jokes. He just cannot.
He just cannot.
And it's so unnecessary. Yeah. It's not important to the character and it's being used as a punchline. It's uncomfortable.
I mean, there's moments where, as like a visual character trait, I'm like, okay, good. Like, it makes Jackram distinctive. I've got no problem with that. And they're big and strong. Fine. But then it's when the jokes come in that you're like, that's a bit much, Terry, come on. But we unfortunately know this about him from other books that we've read. It's just a real blind spot for him.
Yeah, they love it, a bit of fat jokes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I also have noticed it as a thing in a lot of Diana Wynne Jones books as well. This, and it's like a nasty little glee in the describing of these characters who are like characters that we love as well. It's kind of, so you think, are we getting around? Is this actually? But no, it just keeps.
Yeah.
It's a bit much. Yeah. But I like when he. I really like Jackram's physical strength and power, and at least that.
And presence.
Yeah. I think that his fatness is really. I don't know. I feel like it is kind of important in a way. Like, it could be such a cool way to have a fat character. But, yeah, it is the kind of the punchlines that take that away a little bit.
Yeah, the lingering gleeful descriptions, I think, is.
I think it's probably fair to say there's fewer of those in this book than you might expect from such a major character, given how much he makes of other, you know, less frequently encountered characters in other books. So I think it's probably not as bad. And there are some nice moments, like there's a bit later on where Jackram sort of says, yeah, they don't expect a fat guy to know how to fight. And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, you're using other people's stupid perceptions against them. Great. I'm all for that. But, yeah, there's when he's introduced and then there's a few other times where there's just some unnecessarily mean descriptions. Yeah. But we do, I agree, love Jackram, right? We're all on the same page.
We love Jackram.
What a character.
I love Jackram. Oh, my God.
I mean, borderline psychopath, let's also just put that out there, like, has killed a lot of people and does not seem to ever stop to think too much about it. Although there is a line later in the book about how that's why he's choosing to retire at the end of the book. It's like, oh, I killed some guys today and I stopped and thought about it. So I think maybe it's time to stop.
Kind of bad.
but, you know, they also address that as like part of military training. It's like, you know, if you're fighting in a war, I mean, we would hope that we can put an end to this, and I'm hoping that somewhere this book is kind of leading Borogravia, but they make the point that if you're a soldier, that they'd have to train you to do that. That's kind of the job, which is horrifying when you think about it, but is accurate, it unfortunately. Is.
Lots of the book is horrifying. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, God, like, felt it particularly at the moment, a lot of that, like, real fucking sharp, direct hits on the mindsets, horrific, violent mindsets that are inherited from fucking dead men.
And there were some specific lines too, like about the kind of lies that are told in wartime and some of that stuff that I'm just like, oh, yeah. Oh.
It's home.
Yeah.
That's what he does so well, though. Like, he just you are going along with it, you're having a good time, and then he just gets you unexpectedly from within.
Yeah.
I think that's how fiction works better than nonfiction in a lot of ways, because you're trotting along, having a laugh, enjoying your characters, and you're like, oh, wait, it's not a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It matches up.
Yeah. But unfortunately, Jackram's not the only person that Polly meets. We get to meet a great character. We also have to meet the probably the most loathsome character in the whole book. Corporal Strappy.
We have to talk about him?
Yeah, we do. We do. At least a little bit. Because in a book like this, like, there were people who were comparing this to, like, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front and stuff in terms of the way that it presents warfare and talks about the people who are involved in it, because it's about, you know, it's about the rank and file soldiers. It's very little about, like, the, you know, famous military commanders. So it has that sort of aspect to it. But we've got to have somebody who's like, we hate this guy, because everyone else has got to be sympathetic for that aspect of the story to work. So we have Corporal Strappy, who we absolutely hate. What a jerk.
He's hateful on a real human level as well, whereas the rest of the book, the stakes are, I don't know, everyone's, all the bad things people do are kind of make sense in this world, and, oh, he's just a piece of shit person to person, not even on any kind of war scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what's the line? Like, everyone could recognize him as a right little bullying bastard, but they were glad that they were not the, like, object of his bastardry.
Yeah. Too real.
Polly also meets the other recruits who become part of her regiment. So they haven't been able to recruit anyone, Jackram and Strappy, and then Polly signs up, and coincidentally, a bunch of other people walk into the same bar and get recruited in the same place. And they all don't like Strappy. And I think one of the things is that he's a jerk to them. And he picks on the one who is most pick-onable, you know, like the weakest link, is the way he would think about it. And he's just a bully.
Yeah. Also, not to like deflect from our conversation, but when they first started saying all their names, I was like, I'm not going to have to remember all of these names, am I? Because there was so many of them. And then you get to know them as individuals over the 500 pages of this book. And I was like, okay, there we go. But then they don't, because of the thing, they don't only have one name. So I'm like, I don't, but it's by that point, you're like, okay, no, I know all these people. It's okay.
Yeah. I feel like we should say now, because if we try to hold this in until it becomes apparent, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, we should just say the secret.
Listener, if you haven't read this book and you don't want to be spoiled for the capital S secret that is hinted at on the back of the book, now is when you should pause this podcast, go and finish reading the book and come back, because we are just, I think we're just going to talk about it. We'll talk about it mostly after it comes out in the book.
We're just going to say it.
But just so you know, the whole shtick of this book is that it's not just Polly who has dressed up to be a boy to go and join the army. It's everyone in her regiment.
The whole monstrous regiment. The real monster all along.
Yes. Which is a reference.
Was being women.
We're all aware of the reference, the hideous blast of the trumpet of the monstrous regiment of women, which was like a pamphlet that went around. I'll put a link to this in the episode notes.
I don't know this.
I certainly was after I read the Wikipedia article 10 minutes ago. Yeah. But yes, you tell.
Well, this is one of those things, like one of my favorite kinds of posts that you see on all the Pratchett forums is somebody reads a Pratchett book and then they're reading something else and then they go, wait a minute. And then they look it up and they go, that's a real thing that he's talking about. He's done this research. And it happens all the time because he did so much research. And, like, this is one of the most heavily researched of his books. There's an interview that I'll put in the show notes, listener, but we've linked to before from one of his last trips to Australia. He did an interview with the Wheeler Center. And he talked about, among other things, researching Monstrous Regiment. And he talked about all the time he spent in little bookshops in London that were run by ladies who liked other ladies very much, was his description of them. And researching, like, all these women who joined the army and all this stuff. And you're like, this is great. Like, he really went all in for the research on this book. I've often said that it seems like he just was sort of a general research monkey. Like, any interesting fact, he'd just hang on to and go, I'll find a spot for that in a book later. But this one, it really feels like he specifically researched all things about, like, what are some of the terrible things that happen in war? What's the soldier experience like? You know, how many women went in how many different militaries and how far up the ranks did they get and all that kind of stuff. He really sort of put a lot of effort in specifically for this book. Yeah, so the thing is, there was a pamphlet and it was titled, and I'm going to mangle the title, but it's something like The Dolorous Blast of the Trumpet of the Monstrous Regiment of Women. And it was like a pamphlet against women's suffrage. I forget where, I think in the UK, and that's where the title comes from.
Pop my soul, I was close to correct. The pamphlet was actually the slightly less dramatic The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. Note the alternate older spelling of monstrous there. It was published in 1558 by John Knox, a preacher and leader of the Protestant movement in Scotland. This was well before the notion of women's suffrage. He was actually railing against female monarchs. Here, regiment is closer to regimen, meaning rulers rather than a group of soldiers. Knox fled to Europe as his views were considered heresy. Scotland and England were ruled by Mary, Queen of Scots, and Elizabeth I at the time, but he was eventually called back in 1557. He got as far as northern France when he discovered his invitation to return had been cancelled, and in frustration anonymously published The First Blast, in which he argued that female monarchs were repugnant to nature, a contumely to God, that means it was insulting behaviour, and the subversion of good order. He had plans for two sequels, a second and third blast, but the first was so unpopular, he never wrote them.
That's so great.
Yeah. Ugh.
Every time you think you can't love it more, this book just like delivers something new.
Yes.
It's good.
That's very satisfying.
And I do like that he doesn't, like, in the context of the book, that is not why they get called the Monstrous Regiment. They get called the Monstrous Regiment because amongst the people who join up in the regiment are a troll.
Are not people.
And a vampire and an Igor. I love that. I mean, look, anytime there's vampires and trolls and Igors, I'm all about it. I love those guys.
It makes me sad that I don't know any.
Mm. I do love each of them very much. I'm a big fan of Jade.
Yeah.
Oh,
I love how
I'm naturally craggy. Why should I have to polish?
Oh, God. Such a good. Oh, I just was delighted.
I don't think about that in the shower all the time.
Yeah, it really resonated. Made me feel better about my crags. What a great lady. I love her. And also, I haven't met an Igor in another work before.
Mm.
So I love Igor Rima.
Love that they don't lisp.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when in character as Igor, does lisp.
But that was clever writing.
Mm. When I first read it, I was like, she's missing some lisps. Like, this isn't consistent. And then I was like, ah, Terry.
How clever.
I see. Yes.
That was very, very satisfying. We should also mention, so those characters and the names they go by at the start of the book. So Maledictus the Vampire, who comes in and they start calling him Sir because, you know, he's clearly nobility. Like all vampires, he's dressed up in a fancy uniform. He's got a sword, which I love the bit where he says the sword's for protection. They're like, you're a vampire, so you know how to use the sword. And no, I never trained with it. It just hopefully makes people think twice about attacking me because if they do, I might rip their head off and that's quite frowned upon. Because they are a black ribboner, so which is the thing where vampires give up blood and instead they develop an insatiable need for something else, which is great. I love that Maledict loves coffee.
I'm sorry, like, Ben, you live here too. Like, Freya, you live in New South Wales now, but I could not help being like, oh, well, Maledict, he's from Melbourne, obviously. His whole vibe is Melbourne. I'm like,
yeah. He lounges.
I got to get my special beans.
His special little machine.
Oh. Yeah.
He wears all black. He's very suave. Like, as in, like, this is not describing me because I'm from Adelaide. But but yeah, it's just every time Maledict was doing anything, I'm like, oh, yeah, I feel right at home. It's like just stepping into Fitzroy.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. I feel like I know some Melbourne folks who would definitely wear a little necklace of pre-roasted coffee beans in case they ran out. Yeah. And then there's also Igor. Igorina, as we will find out later in the book, and Jade, who goes by Carborundum. And the troll names are always so good. They're always great, great rock puns or names of kinds of rock that sound like a name. And there are some humans as well. So we've got Lofty and Tonka, who are kind of an inseparable pair. Tonka being the sort of bigger, tougher, like more aggressive one, and Lofty being the quite quiet one, who, as we find out later, is a bit of a pyromaniac. And we've got Shufti, who's quite a good cook, and who gets described, again, there's like a slight sort of fat joke about Shufti, and then later on we find out why that is. And there's Wazza.
You can say it. She is Grandjean. She's Pregananant.
She's Pregant.
Yes.
Am I Gregnant?
I haven't thought about that for a while.
I think about that at least once a week.
That seems reasonable.
Because we are at that age where everyone is having babies, and every time they announce, I'm like, congratulations, and that video plays in my
head. Oh, no. But yeah, Wazza is the last one, because they've all got like sort of very, very Australian nicknames, aren't they?
Yeah. I read that as Wazza.
Oh, yeah.
I say Wazza as well.
Oh, Wazza. I say Wazza. But I wonder if that's a like country New South Wales kid thing.
And I was like Wazza, like Dazza and Gazza.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They call Polly Ozza because she changed her name to Oliver because of the song that they've all heard. There's quite a lot of references to folk songs in this, but a lot of the folk songs mentioned in this book are real English folk songs, including Sweet Polly Oliver, which is about a girl who goes off to war to find her. I don't know if it's her brother in the song.
It's about following your lover. So, and there's a whole lot of dead brother in this. So, I don't think it's literal, her story.
No, no. But it is about, you know, dressing up and joining the army. So she changes her name from Polly to Oliver, and they call her Ozza, which is, again, that's an Australian
kind of
name. So
Australian.
I'm feeling very represented.
The thing about this, though, is that Pratchett, I think by this stage, he had a whole period where he would come out to Australia to do a signing tour pretty much every year, and he really loved it here. And he wrote the book that was set in a Discworld equivalent of Australia, which is quite a few books before this one, I think at least like probably a few years before this one. So he may well have been inspired by Australian nicknames. Who knows?
Jezza! Awesome.
I can imagine trolls using those kind of nicknames somehow.
Mm. Yeah.
But this is the gang. The gang gets together. We don't know them that well at the start part of the book. But before they head off, I mean, there's some great stuff. We can't mention everything that happens in the book because we'll be here for like 10 hours. It's so long and there's so much great stuff. But there's some fun stuff.
Can we just read the book to them?
No. I feel like that would get us into some trouble.
Why would you say no to that?
There's some fun business in the bar with them getting drunk and also showing off their characters and stuff.
I know I said I only remember that one scene, but there's that thing where things unfolded like one foot in front of you. So that scene in the bar when you go in knowing that they're all women, you sort of go, they're all trying to be like what they imagine men are like. And so watching like people's like, okay, how would a man act in a bar? And like Jade's like, I'm going to take my shilling, split it and like make that drink. And then she's like passed out on the floor for like 12 hours and wakes up at an inopportune moment. It's just a beautiful scene when you go in knowing
what is
actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. I love Maledict in that scene particularly too, because he's always standing up for people. Like he interrupts the barman being a jerk and grabs his arm and, you know, sort of flexes his like immense vampire strength in order to to behave. I really was like, okay, this is a very principled vampire. I'm into this.
Yeah.
Well, he's got to be a Black Ribboner.
That's true. He would have to be. They spend the night there. Polly's got to go to the privy. And that's when a thing happens that then hangs over the book for quite a long time, which is that someone speaks to her while she's in the privy, letting her know, I know you're a girl. I mean, they don't say it in as many words, but they let on and they say, but I'm not going to tell anyone and this might help you out. And they give her a pair of socks, which becomes a recurring joke throughout the book because, you know, she balls them up, stuffs them down her pants.
She what's them up? Sorry.
Well, I said balls them up, but now I regret that choice of words. She wads them up. That's not better, really, is it?
It's a perfect choice of words.
But, you completely dicked that one up. Sorry. Complete fallacy.
I've never done drag as a man. I've never needed to, like, stuff anything down there. But the way that she described having to sort of leave a bit of the sock hanging out so she could tuck it into, I was like, really? Does the I guess that they would. They go down one leg or something. So it was really interesting for me to going, yeah, there's a lot more mechanics involved in that than I had previously considered to make that work.
Mm.
So those little practical touches that shows that not only does Polly think about everything, but Pratchett thinks about everything as well.
Well, apparently they think about that when if you're getting pants made, like by a proper like pants making guy, a tailor, if you will, like they ask if you dress to the left or the right. So that's like a thing, because it impacts how they make your pants.
Yeah,
it's a Pratchett level euphemism, but yeah.
My jaw is just wide open. What on earth do you dress left or right? So as in,
yeah. So for which side's it on?
Which side are your socks being pushed into?
Yeah.
What on earth?
So why is there like a time in childhood where you like that just it becomes like a default side? Like,
is it left-handed and right-handed related? Like, do fewer people? I gotta know.
I don't know. I don't think it's much of a thing anymore. I think it was more when pants were tailored and so they were a lot tighter because they were just the right size for you, it was a thing. But now that, you know, most people don't wear tailored clothing anymore, it's all off the rack stuff that's never quite the right size for you anyway. I think that they've got a bit more give in them. So certainly it's never been something I've had to think too much about.
Let them flap around.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is apparently something that if you are getting pants made, they'll ask.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. But I wonder if it's also because we wear different kinds of underpants now than we used to, whether it's not as much of a thing. Anyway, this is not what I thought we'd be talking about.
I think it's amazing.
You didn't think we'd be talking about this in the book the women are pretending to be men?
That's a good point. I mean, what other book would we be talking about it in? I don't know why I'm surprised.
I mean, it is a good point.
But I do. Oh, no. They have that sort of business at the start. We get to know the characters a little bit. And then they head off towards a training barracks in a place called Plots. And I do just want to give a shout out to all of the place names in this book because they're so good.
Yeah.
Lips and Neck and Plots.
Yeah. And then there's the capital, which is like named after like 18 different kings or princes or something, all just strung out in a row, which I thought was hilarious. And they don't really know what's going on in the war, but they all have these suspicions. So Polly, working in a bar, has a better idea of what's going on than most of them because she's heard a lot of discussions from soldiers and even has some gear that was left behind by a dying soldier. So they're pretty sure that Borogravia is not doing well in the war. And we know that for sure because we've already had a scene with Vimes, who's been sent on behalf of Ankh Morpork, who are sort of siding with the invading army of Zablenia, also such a good name. And they're mainly siding with them because one of the things that Nuggan has declared an abomination are Klax Towers. And there was a line of Klax Towers going through Borogravia and they've burned or dismantled them all. And Ankh Morpork's like, well, this is no good. We need to be able to send Klaxes in that direction. So we'll have to help with this invasion. So he's there. And that was a big surprise to me that he turned up so early in the book because my memory of Vimes in the book was that he wasn't in it very much at all, like hardly at all. I mean, and he's not in it that much. Like if he's in 2% of the book, I'd be surprised. But my memory was that they're on a battlefield somewhere and they just run into him and he says something and then buggers off. That was my memory of how it worked. And now I don't know if I'm remembering another book where that happens or if I just had such a terrible memory of this book that I just really made that up in my head.
He really does kind of like flit in and out, though. Like, that kind of makes sense as how you would remember it. On this reread, I was like, whoa, yeah, he does just, like, there's not even a section break, really. It's just a new little paragraph, and there's this guy, Vimes, and I was like, I have no idea what's going on. I remember the first time I was like, hold my hand more. But this time, I didn't even need it. I was so thoughtful. I didn't even need my hand held. I knew who he was. But I also really like that. It's kind of bullshy the way he turns up in the writing. When I was reading it this time, I was like, out of nowhere. But I love his occasional just little perspective shifts that he gives the plot.
Mm.
Yeah, like for me, when I read this, and it's hard for me to remember the order I read things in – originally, but I know I read this one very early on, and this was how I met William de Word and Otto. Like, I hadn't read The Truth before this one. So I really love how this is kind of like an inverse of, if you're familiar with Discworld, it's the other way around. So like, characters pop in and you don't have to know who they are, but like, they're normally dominating their own books, and here they're just kind of like popping up to be like, I'm doing a thing, but I'm a side character to give some context. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's such a delight to me of novels in the same world.
Yeah, and I really like the decision to have sort of that early on scene with Vimes getting briefed about the situation in Borogravia. So we're filled in on what is going on there, and it, you know, that he doesn't have to find some torturous way for the regiment who all live in Borogravia and know all this stuff to be talking about it, or don't know it. Like, they don't really know the truth of how bad things are about the war, or that, you know, Borogravia's got so few people left who can tend the farms and so little food left in their stores that they're all going to starve to death in a few months anyway. Like, it was really, having Vimes sort of drop in and learn that and talk about it, you were like, oh, okay, wow, they're really in a bad way. It's not good. And that kind of, you know, it makes sense, because like in a lot of the war films that have a similar feel, they're historical films, so we know how bad the war was because we've seen history, but the characters in the story don't know because it hasn't happened yet, or they're just not aware of it. And I think this gives it that same kind of feel.
But do we really get that many war films in the Western world from like the losing side? Like, you kind of get like the downtrodden, our lads are suffering, but ultimately they generally win. And that's not really what we get here. Like, I think this is really unusual in that if we'd had like a classic Vimes, like visiting, doing a diplomacy thing. And I do think it's worth pointing out that it's a bit fucked that their motivation for sorting this out is, oh, they're knocking down our Klax towers. Like, that's the thing that's going to get us involved in this sort of ongoing destruction of this society that is actually quite nice and innocent underneath all of it. But like,
is it though?
Whereas in like, Nuggin sucks, the war ending is good, all of that is, but like, in terms of everything we have, like, it's realistic that that's the reason why the superpower, which is Ankh-Morpork in this situation, would get involved, because you're messing up our technology. You're knocking down our towers. It's messing up our ability to communicate. And it's because your border keeps changing and your god is strange and all that. But if they were just over there fighting amongst themselves, would they have gotten involved? I don't think so, because they haven't previously. Like, I do think it is a bit, and again, we have an R rating on this podcast, so I can say fucked, that it takes that for the superpower to get involved and throw their weight around to sort things out.
It's also wishful thinking that, you know, at some point they realize that they're probably backing the wrong side and that they're supporting an oppressor against a vulnerable people, no matter how jerky that country may have been in the past, and change their mind.
Because the oppressor is helping their technology.
Yeah, that's right. But they change their mind about that.
It's accurate.
Right? So that's quite a hopeful view, right, of how that works.
But I do think it is worth mentioning, because like, it's realistic. I think Pratchett did a real justice to what he was, like, overall what he was trying to say here, because like, the whole thing is about getting into all the different levels of war and how ridiculous it is and how fruitless it is at all levels. And like, Ankh-Morpork isn't going to weigh into this like small battle that we're not really talking about in the other books unless it affects them the same as it does in the real world. So yeah, I guess it's realistic in that way. But what I'm saying, like, my key point was that I think it's rare to have a story told mostly from the perspective of a team from the losing side and arguably one of the wrong sides as well, because like, we have that scene early on where like, it's the, are we the baddies moment where they go into that hut and they see that elderly couple and they assume that it's the people that they've been told by propaganda who are the real aggressors, but it's their people who did that. And like, Jackram's like, oh, well, it's probably deserters. It's probably this, but like, we know that it's not. So it's an unusual story and it's quite a bold choice as an author to sort of wade in from the losing side, but the people that we're seeing aren't the villains because they've been fed the nonsense too.
And when they're kind of explaining newspapers, I love that. But, and the Borogravians are like, what, like a diary? But yeah, the thing of them being like, have you ever heard of human interest, and how this clucky little group might turn the tide of the war because people are finally interested in something because they haven't been interested in this huge, you know, terrible war for so long.
They hit horribly.
Now there's a fun little exciting, titillating detail of these people's real lives. I think that was a really cool, smart bit. I love a place that doesn't have news and is so suspicious of the written word. Like, I love Jackram talking about once people start writing things down, like, you can't trust anything anymore. Yeah.
Great bit of foreshadowing as well, actually.
Yeah. I love the news.
I think that's Terry Pratchett bringing his, like, journalist days back in, like, years later, but sort of tapping into what he saw, experienced, and felt as a journalist, as a young journalist at a newspaper.
Cool. Yeah, I think so.
It's a smart book on every level is what I'm saying. Like, he's doing good stuff. He's doing unusual things, and he's tapping into some of the worst of human nature, but showing it in a way that is palatable, interesting, original, and unusual.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's true.
And somehow also funny.
Yeah. When they get to Plots, the great name of the place, they find out some pretty shocking things. First of all, they get a much better idea of how bad the war is going, because on the way there, they see a bunch of refugees escaping from the front. They see a bunch of soldiers coming back who are wounded, and Igor insists on trying to do something to help them. But then when they arrive, they see that there's no other recruits there. Like, they're the only ones. And it becomes apparent that they are the last volunteers to join. There's no one else to join the Borogravian army. This is it. They're the last new regiment. And what's more, like, there's no equipment left. Like, there's all those great scenes with Three Parts, the quartermaster, who's got, like...
Three Parts that I love so much. Oh, I'm sorry, like...
What a great character.
I love spin-off book, please.
Yeah, read it.
No, I love...
Prequel, sequel, everything.
And yeah, just that, like, and he's got that, he's got stuff, like, there's that great bit where he's like, he has got some better stuff stashed away, but it's not really much better. It's like,
it's better, but it's worse.
Yeah. It's like, well, the bits of armor that were better, but they've all got holes in them and you're going to have to repair them. Yeah, that was great. But there's no real gear. There's very little food left. They're eating like horse bread and, scubbo.
Scubbo.
A terrible thin soup made from whatever they can find. They meet their new officer.
This is like pure scubbo, is like just water. Like, it's
it's like homeopathy. It's like scubbo is like.
Reader, we are like 90 pages into like a 500 page
so much. Homeopathy?
Yeah. But it is. It's like that.
But
scubbo is the food version of homeopathy.
And that's how they bust Shufti, like, as a woman, because she is cooking.
She cooks too good.
Yeah, she cooks too good, and she wants to put the very special sherry onto the cooking, and then she says sugar instead of a spicier word.
And she's the second person.
Figures it out.
Yeah, she's the second person that Polly figures out is also a girl, because she also catches... And
Polly doesn't figure it out. Polly has to keep being told initially.
By Meledith.
No, I'm sure she figured out Shufti, didn't she?
I feel like she doesn't want to know. She doesn't want to believe it. But it's Meledict who takes her aside and is like, you ever hear a man say sugar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then she's like, well, yes, I did notice that. But I thought in
but the... surely it's just really well brought up, maybe.
But she has also, before that, she's also found out Lofty, because she happened to stumble upon her while she was in the bushes. And she thinks...
Yes.
Ah, Lofty, and of course she's followed her boyfriend Tonka into war.
So heteronormative.
Yeah. And they kind of they shy away from it a bit. Like, later on when she finds out that Tonka is also a girl, she's like, but wait a minute, huh? And she does have that kind of-
Then Melbourne Maledict is like, your world is opening up, isn't it?
Yeah. So Maledict's like, well, you'll get it. And then when they tell Blouse, like, towards the end of the book, Polly just says, don't go there. And you're like, what do you mean? What? Don't go there.
That was funny. Yeah, that was a funny little, I thought about that moment.
Let them be in love. Come on. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
But Blouse.
Yeah, but Blouse, they meet Blouse. And I look, I don't know how you feel about Blouse, but I loved him. I mean, I love nearly everyone in this book, but I really, I felt everything about him is he's really trying to do his best. He's just, he's hopelessly out of his depth. It's really not what he's good at. And yet there are moments where his talents shine through and he really does try to use them both to look after his regiment, but also to do his job and try and win the war on behalf of his side. And so he's got that thing of being sort of hopelessly ridiculous, but also very competent in certain weird ways.
His heart's in the right place.
Mm. Mm. I feel like if I were a character, unfortunately, I do feel like I would be Blouse.
Yeah.
Like 100%, I feel like I have secret, like I'm useful in other ways. That's how I feel about myself in this life. And I feel like that's how Blouse is.
Yeah.
Yeah, his heart's super in the right place. And he learns his lessons.
Yeah.
Which I love in a man.
Yeah, I have respect for Blouse.
Yeah, he's such an idiot, but he's...
But he's a very smart idiot.
Yeah, he's kind.
He is.
Oh.
Yeah, he's a sweetheart.
He's kind, but he's also... He's willing to unleash when people wrong his guys.
Mm. Mm.
Which makes me respect him more.
That's true. I think, you know, he really comes through when he's having the interview with William de Worde. Like, I think he really comes across as very strong there. And there's a couple of times where he stands up to Jackram and sort of says, no, this is how we're going to do it. And he's right about that in that moment where you're like, oh, yeah. But the rest of the time you're like, what are you doing, mate? Come on.
Bro.
Yeah. He turns up and he sort of announces that I'm going to be your new commanding officer. You're our regiment. But we need everyone to get into the fight. So, Strappy, you're going to be joining us at the front. And he pisses himself, which was very satisfying.
Quite literally, I'd like to emphasize, like thank you, Terry Pratchett, for that.
Yeah, that was great. But also, he gives Jackram his discharge papers. He's like, you've been serving in this army for so long, it's time for you to retire. And Jackram's like, what? No, I don't think so. There's that great bit about people have tried this before, like he's supposed to have been retired before, but nobody else is dared to actually give him the papers and say, go home. So that was kind of amazing. And it also, it's part of this part of the book and then several other things that happen after it kind of really ramp up the idea that Jackram is this huge, like, legend of the army of Borogravia. Mm. Like, he's met everybody. Everyone's heard his name. The enemy are all frightened of him because he's been around for so long and he's been part of so many big battles. Yeah, I kind of liked that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like Gandalf.
He's got lore.
Yeah. But Strappy, being scared shitless or pissless, as the case may be,
or both. We don't know.
That's true. He absconds in the middle of the night, having stolen stuff from all of the regiment and smashed Maledict's coffee machine, which is what a jerk.
What a bastard.
I know, he doesn't even steal it.
He's a small man. He's a small man.
Yeah, he really is.
Yeah, I would absolutely interrupt his fruit platter or whatever the euphemism is. I would Prince Heinrich him in a moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The Heinrich maneuver is what we should call that from now on.
Yes. Yes.
There we go.
Very good.
But this is where I love that there's so many layers to this, just like there's all these layers of disguises as we get further in. But it starts here because the other thing that happens while they're here at the barracks is as they're trying to scrape together some stuff so they can get ready to go into the war, a Zablinian patrol arrives looking for them, but Polly is in the bar and is left sort of in there to delay them. So she sort of takes off parts of her uniform and pretends to be a barmaid, at which point the soldiers kind of, you know, are leering at her and their commander tries it on. So she kicks him in. Well, she does a Heinrich maneuver.
She knees him.
She knees him. That's right.
She knees him. In the socks.
Yeah, so like,
in the socks, yes.
The media gets it wrong.
That's
like,
right.
They're like, she kicks him, but like it's different if you knee versus if you kick.
That's true. But they overpower the soldiers who've come looking for them and they tie them up. And they find out they were looking for them specifically because they knew this was the last regiment. And they thought, what a great coup for us. If we can capture the last regiment, then we can just invade and we don't have to worry about anything. but they get the better.
And they were looking for a photo opportunity as well. Is part of the point? Like they had like liaised with the media, being like, "We're going to do you a nice photo op of us, like just getting these little lads."
Yeah, but that's not what the photo is of, because they tie them up in the nude and leave them in the inn.
And then, nude with a double O.
Yeah, they all say it like that, don't they? Again, a bit Australian.
Because it's funnier.
Although I guess it would be more Australian to say nutty, wouldn't it?
I love nutty. Is that Australian? Nutty?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, where I grew up, people would say that sometimes. Yeah.
Cute.
I grew up in a British Chinese family, so we would say naked.
And only naked. You would use no other word for that state of affairs.
Whilst fully clothed, we would say naked.
Yes. But the important thing about this is these people that they leave tied up naked, their commanding officer is not who he says he is. He is Prince Heinrich, the leader of Zablenia. And not even William de Werd realizes this until after the photo has been sent back to Ankh-Morpork. Although Vimes knows because he intercepts the news.
And also because he's the best, like, investigator in the universe.
Well, that's true.
Like, I'm hesitant to say the best policeman in the universe because police, but he's he's separate to that. So, yeah,
that's true. And he's not really not acting as a police officer in this book. So, that's nice. We don't have to think too much about
that. Well, he's like a weird diplomat detective. So, like, we'll go with that.
Yes. It does say, I mean, it does seem slightly weird.
Duke diplomat detective.
Yeah, he's a very specific kind of diplomat. He only gets sent on these diplomatic missions when Vetinari's like, I need some diplomacy, but it's diplomacy that's kind of like a murder mystery. Can you go?
Who does Vetinari send for his normal diplomacy?
It's a good question.
Himself.
No idea. Yeah, I mean, he would probably like to do it himself, but he doesn't really leave the city. So, hard to say. So they get out of this situation. They keep going, not knowing that they have kneed Prince Heinrich in the balls, in the socks, And they continue on to the front. But as they're on the way, Polly realizes that everybody except Blouse and Jackram and Maledict are all girls, or at least that's what she thinks at this stage. And she thinks, oh, Lofty and Tonka are together. And she also finds out that Lofty and Tonka and Wazza were all in the girls' working school,
which was foreshadowed.
Yes, it is foreshadowed. That's right.
Just outside her town?
Yeah.
Or is it in her town?
Yeah.
Well, I get the feeling that there's lots of them, but there's one near her town where she lives. And this is, again, it's something that Pratchett is drawing, unfortunately, from the real world, because these places really did exist. Thankfully, hopefully, all of them have been shut down by now. But yeah, horrible, horrible places. So that's their story. They all escaped from there. But Wazza was in solitary, like they put her in the hole for doing something. I can't remember what they do say, I think, what excuse they had for it, but they put her in there and this has kind of made her go a bit strange. So she's the one who's very religiously devoted to the Duchess, is always praying to her, but kind of gets over worrying about the abominations that she's doing herself.
Well, it's because the Duchess gives her an out, because the Duchess has sent her on a mission and she says, no abomination to do on my mission. Count as abominations because you are on a holier like level than this.
She's got an indulgence.
But it's a fascinating look. Like if you put multiple women in this abusive situation, what are the different ways that people will cope?
Yeah.
So like there's the way that you can find each other and like the two in a relationship are very different from one another, but they've found each other and they have solidarity in that and that's beautiful. But like Wazza or Alice, she goes in a different direction.
Polly's seeing them holding hands in a way that, like, she doesn't know how to be around because it's such desperate holding. That connection that they have through a shared trauma, something that's, like, too big for Polly to be able to deal with. I don't know. I thought that was, I love that.
Yeah, the description of that really, that was like an arrow in the heart. That was, like, really full on.
They need each other.
And it's beautiful context because, like, Polly is our protagonist, or Polly, Ollie, is our protagonist. So we feel her feelings first and foremost. She's there to find her brother. She wants to get control of her inn. She wants to go back to her life. But, like, around the edges, we've seen that there's this home for women who are not good enough or who are bad and that you'll be sent to if you're not a good enough woman, and she's been warned about that her whole life. And finally, she's thrust into this situation where she's around those women and they are normal and good and living lives. And so we don't actually realize how privileged Polly's life is until she talks to them one-on-one and sees like how bad their existence has been, except she has, because she's had them come in from this home to work at the inn, and they last a few weeks or a few months, and you never learn their name, and they go back. And she slowly, across the course of the book, learns what's happened to them as they've been billeted out to these different places. And yes, it's great if they end up at the inn, even if they're quiet, but there's so much worse out there for them. And it shows through these three characters how bad it can get and what it does to a person. And I think it's very elegantly done.
It is.
Pratchett.
The ways that you find out what's happened to them, they're real fast, like really quick, like small bits of this big book, like one page where you find out the worst stuff that's ever happened to Lofty.
Mm.
And I feel like that is really affecting. Like it can almost only be dealt with in that really fast way. It can only be like quickly reported, and also that kind of it within the kind of the way the book works as well.
Mm.
It's just like a shot in the ribs that you just know this horrific thing is part of the context of this like big sort of silly farce. I don't know. It's those bits really, really affected me.
Yeah.
And I hope it's not too like audacious or I don't know the right word to say, that is the way that women talk about this stuff to each other. Like at least in my experience,
you'll
be chugging along in your conversation. Someone will throw something in and then continue along.
Yeah.
And you will suddenly get this huge piece of context to their life story. But by the time you're registering it, they'll have moved on to something much lighter. And so I feel like he's nailed that in this book really well.
Mm.
During the start of the – it was interesting rereading this and being more aware of this time. But, like, I would get a little bit annoyed sometimes with kind of how simplistic the kind of gender differences are and are kind of played with. Like, lots of time is given to, like, how it's difficult to fart, which made me be a little bit like, but is it really?
I love to fart. Sorry.
But, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's one of the great pleasures in this life. Mm. I was thinking about it so much reading it that it's almost like a trick, because then it just gets so much deeper at the end in really surprising ways that are really not that superficial men do this, women do this thing.
Mm.
And so my annoyance that I definitely had the first time I read it, but I had a total different view on it the second time, and then like when you get those real true bits that are, I don't know, I don't know exactly what I'm saying, just that it's real clever when you kind of realize he's annoying you in these ways in a very calculated trick.
Yeah.
He's smarty.
Yeah. No, I feel like he gets you in with the simple differences. He's like, men fart and walk like apes and women are delicate and they love to cook. But then he gets into the details of like the conversations that it's difficult to like it's not something that you really genuinely articulate regularly, but it's very authentic. Like he's coming from a place of knowledge and it isn't something that's often in a book. And it's difficult to put in a book like this, which has a plot that's rollicking along that is also humorous, but also feels real. Like it, as I said before, it really does feel like the way that women share with each other. Like, yes, you'll have the D&M sometimes, but you will also be like having a casual drink and your friend will drop
a childhood
devastating bombshell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just drop that casually and then barrel along with the conversation and you engage with it, but you also engage with it on their terms. Cause like if someone wants to drop something and barrel along, you go with them in that way. You have your empathy. You're there if they need, but you also are there with the jokes and everything else to match the pace of what is needed to match their revelation. So I feel like that book did this in a way that I haven't seen very often in literature. because so often an entire book will be built around the trauma in a way that doesn't feel authentic.
Yeah.
I mean, it also helps, I think, that, you know, this is such an ensemble book. Like, you're right, Polly is very definitely the protagonist, and most of what we get is from her point of view. But there's also, you know, this amazing cast of characters who show all these different perspectives and experiences of this sort of horrible, war-torn hell that they all have to live through, which has affected them all in different ways. And even though none of them have been involved in the war until this point, at least not directly. So there's that element to it as well, which just shows this variety of experience and perspective that you often don't get when a book is about this sort of thing. Yeah.
And for some of them, the hell isn't the war. Like, the war is incidental.
Yeah.
But the war is better than where they were.
Yes. I mean, as
it's like, where were you before this? I was getting beaten. Like, that line just is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was. That
yeah, was it was like, what did you do before this? I was beaten.
Yeah. Oh, rough. But I do like that, you know, it's immediately that they sort of come out to each other and they know each other's secret, that binds them together in a way much stronger than when they were pretending to each other. And it's such an important contrast to what happens at the end of the book as well. But there is this thing where, well, we have the secret, you know, maybe that can be our superpower. Like, we can use that to our advantage now that we all know and we're all in this together, which is just kind of lovely. And that they each have their own reasons for doing it. You know, like two of them are just sort of running away. One of them is kind of on a holy mission. Two of them are looking for someone that they've lost. And then there's another couple who are just trying to, well, three of them who are just trying to prove that they're as good as any man, basically, is their main reason for being there. Because we don't find out until a bit later that Carborundum is also a girl, because they can't really tell, because they don't. She's a troll. She's a big hunk of rock.
She's naturally craggy.
Yeah.
They do, like, delay the mystery. Well, like, one person delays the mystery well, because you're like, are they a woman? But then you're like, is Maledict a woman? Is Jade a woman? Like, how's it going? And then, like, spoilers, Jackram is a woman.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, the other mystery,
beautifully done.
He also leaves that dangling as to who was it who spotted Polly at the start. And for a long time, you know, Polly thinks that it was Maledict because, well, a vampire would probably be able to know, right? I've fooled everyone else. We're not going to fool a vampire. But then it turns out, no, it wasn't Maledict at all, which is, I love that as well.
Yeah. Layers, like ogres have layers and this book has layers.
Let's get through a bit more of the plot, because this middle part, like, there's so many great things that happen, but again, you know, it's a 500 page novel, we're gonna have to skip over some stuff, but once they know each other, girls, they're like, okay, we'll all keep each other secret, it'll be fine.
Also, they don't know about Jackram at this point.
Oh yeah, they don't know.
They spoil that early, but yeah.
And Blouse doesn't know.
And Blouse doesn't know, and they don't know
which
about
makes
Maledict
for a delightful something later.
Oh yes. That's true. But they do have a successful engagement with the enemy, because they notice the Klax towers that the enemy is using to communicate, like light up Klaxes to use in the night. And Blouse is like, have you not figured out, like, that one is shining quite in our direction? That means there must be somebody signaling back nearby. And they figure out they're on the top of the hill. And Blouse has this, like, he basically goes, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to capture them. Admittedly, you know, with a lot of help in this first instance from Jackram, who has that very Pratchett-y idea about how sergeants work, you know, like the officer makes the decision of what needs to happen, but the sergeant is the one who works out how it's going to happen and makes it happen, which is a theme that comes out in one of the Science of Discworld books as well. But that's kind of the relationship that they have, except, of course, when Jackram is calling the shots but letting the officer think that they are making the decisions. But despite Jackram sort of trying to dissuade them from doing this in the way that Blouse wants to, they do manage to capture both a mobile Klax tower and the code book so that they can use it. But Jackram kind of gets his revenge on Blouse, like, sort of telling him what to do. How dare he tell me what to do? He's just an officer. But he gets his revenge by nearly letting him get injured by a prisoner before he shoots him through the face. And they do. I mean, I love that. Look, this is not the point of the book, but the descriptions of how awful all the weaponry is also really got me.
Yeah.
Like the horsebows that they're carrying, which are like these sort of modified crossbows for use on horseback, are like, whoa, this is intense. That sounds nasty.
I would rather be killed by a nasty weapon than a mediocre weapon.
Whoa, really?
Okay.
That's
well, like, you said that you would probably be Blouse in this thing, but I was like, I would probably be that weird soup that they're all eating and hating. That they're all like, that's boiled too much.
Wow. That's so mean to yourself, Liz. But if wow. I just
don't see myself in this book, like, as in, like, I'm not the kick-ass Polly character. I don't have, like, the grit of the three women from the workhouse, basically. My zombie strategy has always been to die in the first wave. So, like, I think I'd be the soup.
Okay. All right.
It's hearty.
I'd love to be, like, Jackram or Polly. I'm just not.
Mm. Yeah. I don't – well, look, I feel like somewhere between the two of you, I think. Like, I feel like I could be a little bit Blouse-like, but probably I would end up in the soup quite soon. Yeah. Thankfully, I won't have, well, you know, knock on wood, I won't have to find out. But, yes. They make camp after their daring raid on the Clax Tower, and they meet up with William DeWord again, who's wandering around, who's actually looking for them because he has now discovered that, yes, it was Prince Heinrich that they did their Prince Heinrich maneuver on. And so he now wants to follow up with them and go, do you know about this? Because they've become a sensation in Ankh-Morpork. Everyone's like, oh, we can't believe this. They've done like a political cartoon about it, which is printed in the front of the book, which I deeply enjoyed. That sort of really old-fashioned, like, yeah, not at all subtle political cartoon. Very good. I mean, some modern political cartoons are not very subtle either, but then that's not really their point, is it? So they find out about the cartoon, and this is where they see the newspaper. They have the big conversation about it. Because they'd kind of talked about it before, but they hadn't seen one except for like a torn strip off one that Polly finds that she reads like half, and it's reproduced in the book with like increasingly small bits of text because she's got a diagonal tear of the newspaper and she's trying to figure out what it says.
Like when you're trying to read someone's like Instagram story, but like you can't like quite see all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
When does that happen?
Yeah, when does that happen, Liz?
No, like when – oh, no – I guess it's not story. It's more like when someone has a post of like their like article and you try, but they haven't got the whole article. So you're like trying to read it and you're like, yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Like, I don't have a subscription to that. And I'm reading it from your photo and I want to support obviously journalism and culture, but I also am trying to read your story and you've artfully cropped off half of it. So how much can I understand from that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's exactly like that.
So yeah, not stories, craftily done Instagram posts that are beautiful and artsy and impossible to read.
Mm-hmm. But this is also where we get the name of the thing in the thing, which to quote another Terry Pratchett podcast, who loves this when it happens, but I also love this when it happens. I used to read a film magazine occasionally and they would have a little section where they'd ask you to guess how far into a film they say the name of the film in the film. And like people could send in their times and guess how close they could get, which is great. But yeah, in this they get called the Monstrous Regiment because they have a troll and a vampire and an eagle and a werewolf. They think there's a werewolf, but there isn't. But there is a werewolf, just not in the regiment. We'll come back to that, I'm sure, at some point. But yeah, this is where they have the second interview and Blouse is talking to William DeWord and kind of like I think makes a pretty good showing of himself, particularly because after the interview – Jackram's like, you just told him where we are, sir. And he's like, no, you see, Sergeant, because I did what we call a lie. which I thought was great because he's quite smart on some level and he's read a bunch of books about military tactics. So he does make some smart decisions, but yeah, he's not necessarily always right. But I love that bit. That was great.
He can do the military decisions that don't involve actual fighting.
Yes. But this is also where Maledict is starting to really feel the pinch because he's got no coffee. And if he doesn't get any, he's going to revert to proper vampirism. And there's that great bit where Otto, the photography vampire from The Truth, takes Polly aside and he says, look, I just want to tell you about your friend. Like, it's going to get bad if he doesn't get any coffee. He's going to start hallucinating and then they're going to be psychic hallucinations that are going to infect you. You're going to have them too. And this is like a weird way of Pratchett like inserting not just these sort of, you know, World War One and sort of, you know, 19th century idea of warfare tropes, but also getting some Vietnam War stuff in there as well, because that's what Maledict ends up hallucinating. He sees like flying machines in the air making a thwop, thwop, thwop noise, and he starts talking in numbers and he writes like Born to Die on his hat. He just goes the full like Full Metal Jacket, Apocalypse Now kind of crazy.
I can't talk about Apocalypse Now. I watched that movie with my parents as a teenager and it disturbed me so badly. I had to do a mosaic dolphin puzzle for like 2 hours before I could go to bed after watching it. So
fair enough, man. I haven't seen it.
Don't.
I'm really good at steering clear of stuff that's going to make me feel bad.
I think that's wise.
I feel like I'm a tough movie watcher. I can watch a lot of movies. That one got me in a really weird way. So like, unless you have like a really good puzzle, don't watch it.
So what you're saying is don't watch Apocalypse Now, just do a really good puzzle instead.
Yeah.
Yes. Hmm.
Well, after advising Polly about the whole vampire hallucination situation, Otto takes a photo of the regiment and then he and William leave. And that's when Blouse, as we talked about earlier, says, no, it's okay. I haven't told them our plans.
I told him we were going to try and mop up some deserters and reconnect with the army. But actually what we're going to do is we're going to go to Neck Keep, the keep right on the river. It's on the border.
Neck.
And it's this big, massive keep that has been taken by the enemy forces, including Commander Vimes. That's where he is. And we're going to try and take it back. And Chakram's like, are you crazy? Like, that is never going to work. There's like five of us. I mean, there's like eight of them, but still. It's a ridiculous plan.
Yeah, 5-8 against an army is much the same.
That's true. But Blouse is like, no, we're a small, we can go where a big battalion could never go. Which is how I kind of imagine him speaking. Like, he's got that sort of.
He's got a plummy Eton accent. But also, like, where did he go to school? Because, like, this is an interesting point. Like, because he loves the shitty food. And I'm like, did he go to fancy school that serves shitty food, or did he go to a shitty school that serves shitty food?
Yeah, it was.
Fancy school with shitty food.
That's where I ended up. But I there was a little bit of ambiguity there. Was like, was he just a very talented student at a slightly shitty school, or was he at a fancy boarding school where part of the charm was they fed you absolute swill? And I think it was the latter in the end, but I agree there was a bit of ambiguity there.
Correct.
Because I feel like for the children, they don't mind, but like at a very fancy school, the parents would be like apocalyptic.
Well, no, because I think it's that sort of English boarding school kind of trope. It's good for them, you know?
Character building.
Exactly. Where they have a horrible experience by design, you know? Turn them into men or whatever. Blouse announces, like, we're going to find a way into the keep, and puts his foot down with Jackram, who does not want a bar of this, but he's like, no, we're going to do it. And it's a real source of tension between them. But the plan that they come up with is that, well, we need to send someone in there and we're going to find an entrance. And the only entrance they find is the washerwoman's entrance. So we're going to dress up as a washerwoman and we'll go in there. Jackram's like, all right, fine, we'll do it.
We will send the one man.
Yeah. And they
can only
to pretend to be a woman.
Yeah, they've only got enough clothing to send one person. And Blouse is like, well, clearly it must be me. I'm the only one with experience dressing up as a woman. Don't you know? I was in the amateur theatrics. And I know how to do a woman.
He must have bazongas, though.
And I can imagine, I don't want to do it, but I imagine his voice, like, and particularly because the kinds of character that he talks about playing, they all sound like they're from a pantomime, you know? And I'm imagining kind of, real, not good. And he's kind of, it's interesting because, you know, in a previous book, in fact, the previous book where the theme was really centrally war, which is Jingo, we had Nobby and Colin dressing up, you know, to sort of disguise themselves as Clatchians, and Nobby dressing up in effectively a belly dancer's outfit is the kind of thing he was wearing and pretending to be a woman there. And they had that old trope. In that book as well, the joke was, oh, and all these men find him irresistibly attractive, which is, of course, the comedy thing to do with a man who's very badly dressed as a woman. But here we get that again with Blouse, but it's very much lampshaded because all these actual women who are disguised as men are like, what is going on? Why does anyone believe this for a second, this horrible performance?
And then all of the women and all the washerwomen are just like letting him. They're like, we just let him do his thing. He seems having such fun. We know he's a man, but he's so good at ironing.
Yeah. He is good at ironing. I learned things about ironing.
Would let him.
Let him do the ironing. Like, he knows what he's doing. Great.
I specifically buy clothes that don't need to be ironed. If someone wants to iron, great. Good for them.
It's the year 2024. No one should have to iron anything anymore.
Yeah, you should just do what I do. And, like, if something is really rumpled, like, you stand in the room that you recently showered in, like, just pulling on the clothes that you're wearing and hoping that sorts it out.
You know what? It works well enough for most circumstances.
And also, if anyone is fussed by your clothes being a little bit wrinkled, they're not worth having in your life.
You're right, man.
Yeah.
I'll pay that. So Blouse goes in, but he doesn't come out and he doesn't give the signal that he says he's going to give. Jackram's like, well, we'll let him do it. Let's go and rejoin the army. But Polly and the others are like, nope, we're going in there. And Polly's motivation is that she thinks that's where her brother is likely to be because she's heard that that's where a lot of prisoners of war are being kept. And Shufti's like, well, I think my young man might be there because I'm pregnant and I want to find him.
What, your young man, John, with a carbuncle on his butt and, like, no other details? Yeah. Was it carbuncle?
Carbuncle, yeah.
I don't know what it is, but it sounds gross.
It's like a big wart, basically, is what it means.
Okay.
But
she doesn't know his last name.
Or much about him.
She does remember his glinting earring, and I can relate to that. That was stuck in my mind, too. I recently went to the Matchbox 20 concert.
Might have seen a few glinting earrings there.
They wouldn't let us review them.
Why? Because they're perfect and unjudgeable?
They're great and I love them. And I was just like, please let us like, but no, it's fine. It's fine.
I'm sorry for bringing it up.
It's okay. Like, as in, I love Matchbox 20. That's fine. That's their right. They're allowed to. They're a band. They're humans. That's okay.
It's fine.
Well, Rob Thomas was wearing an earring and I could see it glinting, even though I couldn't fully see the details of his face from as far away as I was. But the glint, it did it for me.
Oh. But that glinting earring man is what is drawing Shufti towards the keep. She wants to go. Tonka and Lofty want to go where the others are going. They don't want to leave them. And Maledict and Jade are like, yeah, we're going to go with them too. Jackram's like, all right, well, if your heart's set on it, you're going to need some more girls' clothes if you're going to dress up as girls and go in there. So he takes Shufti and Polly to the camp. What's the word for it? It's that not hangers-on, but there's like a similar term.
Groupies?
Camp followers is kind of what they call them. Like, they're people who follow the army along and sort of provide all the services to the army encampment that they might need and also hopefully make a bit of money off them. So there's this kind of city made up of all these people hanging around where the army would have been if there was any army left and they weren't all captured in the keep. But they go there, they go to a brothel and they steal some clothes from some sex workers. And there's a great bit in there where Polly's feeling bad about it until one of the sex workers is kind of an asshole to them. And then she's like, oh, I don't like these people, so that's okay. I don't feel so bad about stealing their clothes now. I thought that was a nice way to deal with that scene. But then when they're getting ready and they're putting their clothes together to dress up as women, so they're now, and this is where we start to get deep into it. Like, they're girls who are dressed as boys who are dressed as girls again to sneak into a keep. But Jackram says, oh, no, you won't get me in a skirt. I'm not doing that. He says, I'll wait outside for you. And if you give me a signal, I'll round up what's left of the army out here and break down the gate. So they get inside. It all kind of works pretty well until they get into the gates where immediately they are found out. And the rest is like, you're not real girls until they prove that they are. Which I was not ready for that. That's probably the most explicit sort of physical anatomical scene in all of Terry Pratchett, where Shufti just sort of lifts up the dress. Excuse me, I've got something you need to look at. And you're like, I was not ready for that. But that's a good response, I feel. And then they backtrack. They're like, oh, we're so sorry. Oh, this is very embarrassing. All right, just go with the other washerwomen, which is when they find out Blouse has successfully infiltrated as Daphne, in inverted commas. And
has a date.
He does have a date with a guard who he thinks he's going to break the neck of after stealing his keys. And you're like, mate, you haven't thought about this. This is famous. Like, early in the book, there's that great bit where he's cut his hand whilst practicing with his sword. And the hand that he's cut is the sword hand that he's holding the sword with. And you're like, how?
Well, you can see how you do it. Because you'd be like, You throw it in the air, you catch it, you catch it the wrong bit.
I think if you look, if you're throwing it in the air, you're already doing it wrong.
Like, yeah, but like he's reading one of those fancy boy books. Like it probably says throw it in the air, catch it, like while you're doing a twirl and then like stab the guy. Like it's the problem is his books.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could be.
But there is a real danger 5 energy to this whole sequence.
Yes, that's true.
What?
Danger 5, if you haven't seen it, is my Adelaide pride coming through, but it is this amazing series where it's like the 60s, but it's also World War II, and it's this elite group of like Nazi fighting like heroes, but they're just very silly, and there's like talking dogs, and there's like an eagle-headed lieutenant, and it's just, it's extraordinarily ridiculous, and if you haven't watched it, find a way to watch it. It's on varying streaming platforms, depending on when you are listening to this. I have the DVD, so I don't have to worry about that.
First season, second season,
you can skip that, but like first season, yeah, do it.
Okay.
Yeah. The regiment, well, now they're in and they're kind of, they're safely ensconced in the realm of the washerwomen, doing all of the washerwomen stuff and picking up gossip and news from the outside. I love this bit of the book because it feels like, oh, they could just stay here, couldn't they? But you know they're not going to. And Polly in particular is just noticing everything and hatching this brilliant plan where, okay, well, they've got to air out the clothes somewhere. They've got to take them up. And we know we've got to go up from here because they're right at the bottom.
They've got to sort out the dirty laundry.
That's where the, yeah, yes. And that's where the prisoners are. So we've got to get up there. And they're all going up in the lift, but the lift gets jammed. So they have to jump out early and break into a bricked up section of one of the higher up levels of the basements of the tower. And we know from previously in the book that those basements are crypts full of zombies. And so that's what they have to contend with, all these zombies of old Borogravian soldiers. And they only get through it because Wazzer, who's still with them, kind of channels the spirit of the Duchess.
Wazzer.
And
say Wazzer. Come on, get Australian about all right, it.
Wazzer.
Wazzer
channels the old Ducho, doesn't she? You know? And then what's next?
The old Ducho.
I don't know what's next after that. I don't know how I come back from this. I feel like I'm gonna have to say, oh no. But I can't really do that. But this is, yeah, Wazzer channels the Duchess, cows the zombies, and they get past them and they're like, yeah, we did it. But then they have a big argument about what this means because Tonka is not into this. Tonka is so anti-Duchess because she sees the Duchess as representing everything that led to the girls' working school. And she's like, "This is, I don't want to believe in the Duchess. I don't think this is real." And then Igorino points out, hey, maybe you could talk a little quieter because those guys over there have heard us. And they get captured. They get captured by the enemy forces, led by our old mate from Ankh-Morpork, Pork, Lord Rust, who only gets one scene, and that's fine because we hate him. He's a douchebag. But but he's there, and it makes sense that he's there. And he actually, you know, once they've captured them, he kind of offers them a pretty good deal. He's like, look, we'll send you home. We're going to win this war. Just, you know, give in, and we'll take you home. Plus, we can find your brother. We can find your, you know, your long-lost fiancé. We've probably got them in the cells. We'll find them for you. And they're like, no, thanks. We don't want to do that.
Trust Rust.
Are you sure? Okay. All right. Fine.
I wouldn't trust Rust in this scenario, but like.
Do you think he would have followed through on that deal?
No, actually.
No? What do you think, Fran?
I'm always so shocked when there are like other possibilities. I just would never have assumed. This is why I'm Blouse. I would have assumed that was completely the truth. I would never have questioned it. I just believed him.
I mean, I believed him.
I'll be absolutely fine in this world.
Mm-mm.
I'm doing fine.
I feel like it'd be low on his priority list. Like, maybe he'd intend to do it, but is he going to do it soon?
Well,
is he going to do it within the next year? Like, maybe everyone dies of old age before he does it. Like, I'm sure he has. I'm quietly confident he has the intentions, but it's not on his high priority list.
Hmm. But I believed it, but it wasn't really because Rust said it. It was because we know Vimes is in the background, but quite carefully not named, just physically described. So the reader who is familiar with Vimes and knows what kind of uniform he wears and that he smokes a cigar, we're going, That's Vimes. Polly doesn't know who he is, but I know who that is. That's Vimes. And he's overseeing this conversation. So I reckon if they take this deal, it's absolutely going to happen. But when they turn it down, he's the one who sort of, he gives them, does he give them a wink? He does something. He like gives them a thumbs up, I think.
He gives them a thumbs
up. That's right. He's like, great work. That's what we were hoping
so
for.
So nerdy.
Yeah, it was cool.
Well, with Vimes, then yes, it would happen.
Yeah. But this is where Lofty's pyromania comes in useful. And it is, I love that it was foreshadowed without you really knowing what was going on in the book. Cause like, they like sleep somewhere in like a barn or something. And then after that, it says like after they left an hour later, the whole place burned down. And when they leave the barracks, it explodes like after an hour or so. And you're like, what's going on there?
Yeah. I was like, is this perfume? Like, is this just like just perfume?
Yeah. And then we find out, no, it's because Lofty's been burning all these places down. While she's very quiet, she has an absolute genius for how to blow stuff up. And she realizes that they're keeping them in this disused kitchen and there's some bags of old dusty flour and there's these barrels and they rig up this whole thing where they're going to light a candle, put a cover over it. Then they're going to drop these bags of flour so that they burst and just fill the air with this sort of flour and dust everywhere. And then they're going to uncover the flame, which is just going to set fire to this flour and make it explode, which is plausible. Like grain silos do explode. Like it's a very dangerous thing to store, mostly because it gets filled with air. And if there's dust in it and it sets on fire, it does go up very quickly. So it's a whole thing, but it's a big explosion and it breaks them out and they steal the keys and they start letting out all of their fellow officers and soldiers. I was interested that, you know, they talk about this earlier. And they say, hey, Blauzer, you know, we'll do this. And he's sort of imagining how he could lead the takeover of the keep. And Polly sort of suggests to him that maybe he only wants to let out the sort of rank and file soldiers because then he'll still be in charge. Because once he lets out anyone higher ranking than him, he won't be in charge anymore. And he sort of seems to go, that's a good idea. But then they don't do that at all. They just let out all of the high ranking officers as well. So I thought that was interesting that they kind of bring that up and then immediately kind of throw it away. Which is, it was fine. It worked well for the story, but it just, there wasn't any commentary on it. And I thought that was slightly weird that it wasn't a decision. It just sort of happened.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. But like, Blouse, by his like background, is not a high, like, as in, like, he's a background guy. He's not the decision maker. He's got, like, by default, he's like, he's sort of like gone upwards. Yeah. Mm. So, like,
that's true.
I feel like either he'd feel a responsibility to let them out or like a relief of not being the one in charge or where the buck stops.
Mm.
But I agree that it's strange to not have that even as a throwaway comment where he's like, actually, nah, I don't want to be the top guy.
I mean, having said that, in between them talking about the plan and then sort of actually being in a position to do something about it, he has been told by Polly that they're all girls. So that sort of changed his view of the situation a bit. And also, you know, they've been captured. So that's sort of also, I think, because I think they also, they didn't hold him. Did they hold him separately? I think maybe they did, or I can't remember now. There's so much that happens in this part of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, they smash it all in. And like the last, like, I don't know, like how are we going to describe it? 3/4 of a centimeter of a book is just chaos.
Yeah.
Just chaos.
Just thing happening after thing happening. I think one important thing we haven't mentioned is that after, like, channeling the Duchess to stave off the zombies, Wazza, as I will now call her in by request, collapses and sort of doesn't move and, in fact, goes into a really deep sleep where even Igorina is like, I'm really not sure if she's properly alive. Like, I've never seen anything like this. And she goes really cold and she goes really hot, which is that sort of classic trope of, how do you show someone's having a really weird illness? Well, you have them run really hot and really cold because that's a bit bizarre. But, yeah, so she's out of it. So, there's a few things that have happened that maybe have changed Blouse's idea about the situation, I suppose.
He is with them in the kitchen because he's the one who lifts the cover.
Oh, that's right.
Over the candle.
Thank you. That's right. Yeah.
He's just kind of got to a point of just accepting that Polly is anticipating his orders.
That's right. He's sort of leaving her in charge. Yes. Well, look, they managed to let out the officers and enough of the army that they basically let everybody who's a prisoner in the keep go. And this means that there's a battle on. They're going to try and retake it. And when one of the high-ranking majors is kind of talking to Polly and says, oh, great, we'll get you back in the war, that's when she really kind of goes, back in the war. That's what's going to happen now. Oh, and you just feel like the way it's written, like when she sort of sighs and everything that's happened up to that point, I felt her shoulders just sink. It was like that ad for the Traffic Accident Commission in Victoria that got shown in a lot of states as like a road safety ad. And it's a guy who falls asleep at the wheel in like a combi van or something similar. And he smashes into the side of like a semi trailer. And they show this like real crash that they've filmed. Obviously, no one was really hurt in it. They've staged it. But then the last thing you see is the semi trailer like pulls to a stop just a little bit down the road. And the guy jumps out of the cab to like go, shit, what happened? Is anyone okay? And you just see him look at the crash and realize no one could have survived. And the last thing you see before the ad ends is his shoulders just go, oh, like this is fucked. And I just kind of imagined Polly doing that at this moment, where she's like, we've come so far. We've actually got what we wanted. We've freed our own side. And we're just going back into another cycle of war. This is shit. And that's yeah. kind of how I felt at that point.
Traffic ads got some power in them. Just like
yeah,
Terry.
Yeah.
It is. It's so, yeah, the men take over. Because that's what men do.
Mm.
Is that the line? Something like that.
Well, there's that. Yeah, there's a line around this part of the book where they kind of use the metaphor of the soldier needs an officer and you try to get a good one who you can kind of influence, but on your own, you can't really do anything. And they use that as sort of a metaphor for the gendered way that their society operates. Mm. And, you know, of course, our society is operated a lot of the time as well. Whereas a woman, you feel like you have to have a man. But at least you can, if you can find a good one who you can kind of get to do what you want to do, then you'll be all right. But if you're on your own, like you can't own property, you can't inherit anything, you can't, you know, in our world, you couldn't have a credit card, you couldn't enter the Olympics, like et cetera, et cetera. Not that having a husband would help you enter the Olympics back when women couldn't be in the Olympics, but you.
Probably tennis, like, you know, you'd be a tennis player, like with your name. And then if you got married, you're Mrs. like whatever his name was like that. And that's still on a lot of our like lists of like our female tennis champions. It's like Mrs. who's a what, like you have their maiden names and then you have Mrs. they don't even have their first names anymore. It's
that's weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Mm.
It's disquieting.
Mm. Mm.
But yeah, this Polly's just had her response to this is just to say nope, and you know what, we're not boys either, we're all girls here, we don't want to do it. And so they get locked up again, but this time by their own side. And they're like, well, we can't escape from our own side. Where do we go? This is dumb. And they get given a similar offer. Like, we'll just send you home and that'll be the end of it. We don't want to talk about it. You just keep quiet about it. And they're like, no, we don't want that either. And so they get into this court martial that's not a court martial. Like, it's a bunch of officers in like a court setting, but they very strenuously say it's not a court martial because they don't want to acknowledge that they're proper soldiers. And they have this great guy, Major Clogston, who supports them, who I loved. What a great little minor character who just shows up at the end.
Mm. Yeah.
Really, really sympathetic.
You're crammed full of great people, this book. Like,
yeah.
It's like if you see like a movie with cameos from all your favorite actors, except they're not your favorite actors until you've seen them like do their role. It's very good.
Yeah. And the courtroom scene is great. Like, it's sort of like, there's not a lot of legal back and forth. It's not that kind of courtroom scene, but there is a lot of arguing and trying to get to the core of why are you doing, like, what do you want from us is kind of the key question. And why are you being like this about it? It just escalates. Like, again, you know, like we're nearly at the end of the book, but there's just more and more stuff happens, even in just this one scene where, first of all, they won't say what they've done wrong. And then when they say, well, we really want you to say what we've done wrong, who should turn up? But bloody Strappy. Who, it turns out, was indeed a political, which is the word they use for a spy, but on your own side, who's like watching their own soldiers. The way he tells it, and we it's never quite clear if this is actually true, but he claims he's a captain who is a spy, but he's been pretending to be a corporal because he was investigating Jackram for alleged irregularities in his war record. But he turns on them and he's like, yeah, they did all these abominations and they lied in order to sign up. And Clogston's like, yeah, but did they? Like, they seem to have done the right thing. And there's this sort of back and forth there. So that's the first thing that happens. But then when it sort of reaches a limit where you're like, well, how are they going to get out of this? They all hear the Duchess's voice say, duck, as Wazza kind of starts to wake up. And Wazza starts to wake up. And so they duck. And there's a massive explosion. as the gates to the keep get taken by the army outside. And, of course, who shows up? But Jackram does to save the day. And then there's the great bit where just when you think, how's he going to negotiate this? He says, I've got some stuff to say, but I'm only going to say it to some of you. And he's got this amazing sway over a bunch of them, including General Frock, who's the head of the army. And this was great too
because they foreshadowed all of this stuff.
Yeah, because but there's this thing where when they ask Blouse, you know, what do you think you're going to get out of this? He's like, oh, well, I'll get the highest honor that a soldier can have, which is they'll name a kind of food or an item of clothing after me. And then from that moment on, you immediately notice that every officer in the whole book from that point on is named something like Frock or Galosh. Or, you know, all these names and clothes and mostly clothes, but also, yeah. Yeah, that's right. His name is Blouse the whole
except
time.
Except that he doesn't get turned into a blouse, though. He gets turned into
a kind of gloves or something.
What is it? Fingerless gloves?
Yeah, that's right.
Fingerless gloves get named after.
So great.
What a delight. Very funny.
So. Fingerless gloves have a name?
I just think they're called fingerless gloves. There probably is a name. I wouldn't be surprised if there is a kind of fingerless glove called a blouse, but I don't think that that is the joke here. I think the joke is that it's not a blouse. but yeah, Jackram's got a hold over all of them, including General Frock, who's had a very fine coach named after him, I'm sure, but who he's like carried him for, was it 14 days or something to save him when he was wounded in a battle. So he sends everyone out except the ones he wants to talk to and reveals that they are all women as well. And that he helped all of them get to high-ranking officials. And it's like a third of the high-ranking officers in the whole army, or roughly. So it's a lot of them. And the best part,
very good at war.
Well, my favorite part about this is that none of them knew about the other ones because Jackram had kept it secret this whole time. And they're all a bit like, wait, what? What you? What me? And they're not like too visibly shocked. Because, you know, I think the possibility of it has already been revealed by Polly and the regiment, but they are kind of still like, holy shit, okay, well, we're going to keep this a secret. And they kind of agree that the regiment can stay in the army, but they've got to pretend to be boys again. But Polly's like, we don't want that. We want to be ourselves. And they're like, oh, well, we don't know about this. And this is when Wazza fully channels the spirit of the Duchess, who speaks to them. And doesn't just speak to them, she promotes Jackram to Sergeant Major and then also says to them, "This girl, like you can tell it's me." There's that great bit where she talks to General Frock and kind of proves that it's her. Although when I was reading it, I was like, she keeps letting him fill in all the details, so she's not really showing that she knows the important details that prove it's her. But I still got
like
this
sense. Psychic.
Yeah, it still kind of made sense though. I think it worked. But she says, we're going to have a truce and you're going to send this girl who will have a little bit of me lingering in her, but I can't be fully present this whole time. And she also reveals or confirms something that Wazza had said earlier, which was that the god Nuggan is dead. He's gone now. He's just this sort of memory of all their hatred and jerkiness. For one.
Yeah.
I mean, the line is much better than that, but it's a great line.
You've made your fear your god. That
yeah.
Stuck in my head. But that's familiar.
I think it's quite similar to that, if it's not that here. Yeah. It's a similar kind of sentiment, which I thought was great. And that kind of breaks the spell and lets them sort of do the thing.
And then there's kind of a flurry of activity. And it's kind of like Lord of the Rings, you know, there's three or four times when the story could have ended there, but it doesn't. It keeps going,
but it's still kind of... makes sense. You know, they do surrender, they take the white flag. Well, they don't surrender, they call a truce, and Polly takes the orders across and ends up speaking directly to Vimes, who wants to know what the people of Borogravia want, not what the, you know, the brass of the army wants. So he talks to her like in private. There's that great bit where he says, you know, what are you proud, like she says, we're a very proud country, and he says, what are you proud of? And she's like taken aback. She has to think about it. She goes, oh, yeah, well, don't really have that much to be proud of. Like, we're pretty crap as a country if I think about it, but we're still proud. And so she sort of negotiates how that's going to work. They're going to buy some food so they don't all starve on credit. And that's like agreeable to the pride of the nation. So Vimes kind of figures it out with her and then goes in to talk to the actual people in charge and convince them that that's what they're going to do. And there's that great bit where he says, I did used to be a sergeant, so I know how to do this, which is very cute. I mean, we also, at this point, we find out that Maledicta is a woman as well. which we hadn't found out until that point. And then there's like this kind of one more scene before we get to the end of the book, where Polly goes back to see Jackram. Although, importantly, she does find Paul, who's been kept safe by Vimes.
And has been given some chalk.
Yeah, that was really kind of beautiful.
We don't get very much Paul time.
Very little Paul time.
That's true.
Oh, and it was that Vimes had put him away carefully so that he couldn't be used to fuck with Polly, right? Which I was like, good shit, Vimes. Got him some chalk. Very pleased with that situation. Yeah. So it was okay that we only saw him flare half a page.
Yeah.
I guess it's also important to see Paul through Polly's eyes, because like that's the most if he was disappointing and not matching like the person she had to protect, the gentle giant kind of guy, it would have undermined a lot of the book. So maybe I would love to see like them together, but seeing him through her memories perhaps was necessary.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Also, we were robbed.
And they do find Shifty's young man, or at least one who matches the description she can remember, and that's a great scene as well. I love that.
Great bit. Because also her shit has been building, just slowly realizing her feminism and desire for independence. And then it's such a satisfying. What does she do to him before he leaves?
She says, "Give me my sixpence back, you bastard!"
Give me my
so good.
They're supposed to split it.
I feel like if that had been her motivation all along, it still would have been satisfying. Like it wouldn't have made sense for the character. But I like that. It evolves from "I'm going to find this guy. I'm going to find the love of my life." And then she's like, "Actually, I'm going to find this guy who got me pregnant and is a complete asshole, and I'm going to get my six. I'm going to get my money back."
Yeah.
He was like, "Good shit. What jerk does that?"
Because he steals it. Like he takes it from her on the pretense that he's going to break it in half.
They're going to split it
and give her half so they can find each other again.
Yeah.
Bastard. He is a bastard.
He's taking her sixpence. Yeah. Like fuck that guy.
I mean, he's also like probably.
But also like 15. Fuck that guy.
Which doesn't excuse his behavior, but I think that's also something about the book that all these main characters are so young. And, when you're talking about them trying to get the farting and the walking right, I'm like, but that is what teenage boys are like. it is a simplistic idea, but there's also an element of truth in it, that particularly for that age range, that I thought was, it's interesting.
Sleep with her, give her a fake name, but don't take her sixpence and say it's a thing. Like, come on. Like, that's one step. Oh, yeah,
that is
too far in the jerk, like, Dan. Like,
yeah, no good.
Yeah.
No good. but then after that, this is when we get the final scene with Jackram and Polly in the kitchen in the keep, where he finally comes out with his story. Because there's been this sort of tantalizing sort of glimpses. That sounds terrible the way that I phrased that.
Oh, are you going to say your DM thing?
My DM
I keep teasing that.
Oh, no, we'll get to this. But up to this point in the story, there's been these sort of little glimpses that Jackram wears something around his neck. Something made of gold that Polly has spotted, and Jackram knows that Polly's seen it. They do have a conversation about it at one point. And so she knows he's got some kind of secret, and she's guessed what it is. Yeah, I also joined up as a young woman disguised as a man. I went in because I had a young man who went off to war, and he treated me much better than my dad. So I went off to find him, and I was a big, strong woman, so I could do a good job. And I rose to the rank of sergeant, and I met him, and I got promoted above him, and he didn't mind. He was very supportive. I had a son, but I had to send him away because I was at war. And also,
what happens before that, though? The really upsetting fucking thing that happens before that. Sorry, I keep swearing, but it's in a paragraph. It's just devastating.
When her man dies, William dies
right next to her, and then she like kills the person who kills him. Like it's like.
It's full on.
Her story is very empowering and good. And then the son happens later. She's like, I was left with a surprise. So like she's lost the love of her life, who she followed into the army, the reason that she's there. And then she has their child, but she sends the child away because she's fallen in love with being in the military as well. But like it's rare that you can feel so like a story within a story can make you so affected and invested in the characters. And I know it's the build-up of Jackram before that, and you're seeing their backstory, but it was so short. It was like so brief, and yet you feel that moment so acutely, and it's just a turning point for that character. So, watching that happen right next to you, and like he was a chill guy who, like, I don't care if you get promoted above me. It's nice that we're together.
Yeah.
And then he just dies.
Yeah. It was devastating. I mean, there's several bits in this book that just are like, oh, and this is probably the last really big one in the book where you're like, ooh. I mean, there's another one after this, but it's more of a nice one rather than a devastating one. But this one was pretty full on.
I feel like that's where, like, part of Jackram dies. Like, it's like Jackram becomes a whole new person after that part of their life closes. So, it's an interesting turning point for them. Mm.
And now they're changing again because they realize that maybe they've lost that love for war that they or being in the army that they once had. Now that they're starting to think about was it okay for me to stab those three guys? I don't know. It's kind of how he phrases it. And also, you know, one of the things that is the clue earlier on is that Wazza, when channeling the Duchess, says something to Jackram about, oh, you should go and find that sword in this place. He very carefully gives nothing away, but Polly notices that he's very carefully giving nothing away. And this is where this comes out, is that he knows where his son is. He's, like, done very well. He's apprenticed to a blacksmith. He makes these really amazing quality weapons, and he's got all these children. He's living a great life.
And he's safe from war because he's an armorer.
That's right. So he's never going to be called up because he's doing it too important a job. And she's like, but, you know, he doesn't want his mum to show up and, like, say, hey, it's me, your mum, who's been pretending to be a man in the army and all this time.
Chews tobacco.
Yeah.
And the gross, abominable woman.
Yeah. And so Polly says, but what if his dad shows up? And that was like, ooh, that was amazing, that part. I definitely did not remember that bit of the book, but I was like, oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
And then there's this line, the last line of Jackram present in the book. We hear from Jackram remotely later on, but it says, Polly paused when she got to the door. Jackram had turned her chair to the fire and had settled back. Around him, the kitchen worked. And it's just, just goes,
I fucking love that.
I'm going back. I'm a man now. That's just how it is. I accept it. Someone found out my secret. That's all right. I know who I really am now. It's kind of the vibe that I got from it.
Yeah.
And making that decision that even though that they were going to leave the war and leave the army behind, they're still going to live as a man. And you're like, great.
Yeah.
A couple of people asked us if we were going to talk about this, but in some editions of the book, that last line where we see Jackram, instead of changing Jackram's pronouns from she back to he, it says she twice. And
so the kitchen.
In the kitchen scene.
Goes around. What is that line? It's like.
Yeah, around. Instead of saying around him, the kitchen just worked, it says around her, the kitchen worked. So it doesn't change Jackram's pronouns back to him at the end of that last scene. It just says her again. And
is that the change or was that what was written originally?
Now, this is the question. As far as I can tell, the version that we read, where the pronoun does change back to him, is the original version. And that's still the version in the current Australian edition of the book. Hasn't been changed. And from what I can tell, it seems, and I haven't been able to confirm this is 100%. So if you've got a copy of the book and it's a different edition, please tell us which version you've got. But it seems like it may well be a change for the American editions of the book. And it is a thing that we know that the American publishers used to make a lot of little changes to the book because they thought that the way it was written might be too confusing for audiences. And Terry Pratchett hated this. He complained. He says, like, it's not me. I don't think American readers are stupid. It's the publisher. They keep changing it. They think people won't get it. I'm guessing the thought behind it was people will be confused about who they mean. So we want the pronouns to agree. Whereas actually the whole point of the scene, or at least as I read it, that last bit, is that it's Jackram accepting, you know what? I am a man now. And I don't need to pretend like that's just who I am. And I can go back to my son and say, hey, it's me, your long lost father. And that's true. You know, that's kind of how I read that. Mm. And there are some people who really don't like that change. And I think I am one of them. I don't think I like that. But it is not 100% clear if that is why it was changed. I haven't been able to get a definite answer on that, but it does seem from which editions have it changed that it is the American one where it was changed that way. I feel like, because I think, you know, one other thing we haven't mentioned is this book is such a touchstone for a lot of trans people because, you know, Pratchett, like he went on a journey with how he wrote about gender. Some of his early books do not have great representations of gender, but this one really like, I mean, and we have to acknowledge it was written in 2003. So, you know, 20 years ago, the public discourse and understanding of these kinds of gender issues was not where it is today, certainly not in the mainstream. And yet, you know, here is pretty much, like, I don't think you can interpret it any other way. Jackram is a trans character. Most of the other women in the book probably aren't. Like, they don't seem to think of themselves that way. But I think Jackram definitely is. And is like a great character who we all love and has been on a real journey.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's, I mean, and I'm not qualified to comment on this in any detail, but we've heard from a few listeners who've talked about how important a book it is for them, even if it is imperfect, because it was representation at a time when there just wasn't any.
Yeah.
And so I think it is hugely important. And so that change really does feel kind of weird, I think.
Yeah.
Totally.
And that is, and even that is not the end of the book, which would have been quite a satisfying end to the book, I feel,
this
that line.
This book had like 10 different satisfying endings.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like every sort of 70 pages, like, oh, yeah, there you go. And then you're like, nope, it keeps going and it's great.
But it does, you know, have this sort of little 6 months later thing. So we get a feel for how things have worked out for everyone. So Polly and Paul and Shufti, who has moved into the Duchess, along with her newborn son, who is named Jack after Jackram. Very, very cute. They're all living together and they're having a great time. And Paul loves the baby and is looking after the baby. And Shufti loves working in the kitchen and helping out around the place. Everyone's very happy and it's great. But Borogravia is not necessarily that great. They've had 6 months of peace, but it's starting to sound like there's going to be another war because that's what Borogravian society is like. They like to pick wars with everybody. They're always fighting. As that happens, Polly gets a parcel in the mail and it is from Jackram, and it's like, here's my old sabers. I don't need them anymore. But also, here's my notebook full of all the secret dirt I've got on everyone who's high up in the army. And this is when Polly's like, okay, if there's going to be another war, there's more than one way to end a war. I think I need to go back and sort this out. And so, once again, she dresses up, but this time, you know, she doesn't have to pretend to be a man, but she dresses up in a uniform and she heads off, leaving a note behind. Runs into Maledicta on the way and she's like, yeah, you know who we need to find? We need to find Blouse because he understood how the Clax works and we're going to need that and I've got a bunch of information. We're going to sort this war out. And I get the real impression that her whole deal was we're going to sort this war out before it gets to be a war. Like, we're going to finish this war without people having to die. That's her whole mission this time around. But on the way, as they're crossing the river on the ferry, they meet a couple more young girls who've dressed up as boys to join the army. And she's like, I know what's going on here. You can join me and I will look after you. And she says Jackram's famous line, which is, you are my little lads or lasses, whatever you prefer, and I will look after you. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of it's a mixed.
Yeah.
How do we feel about that ending? Because it's a bit of a mixed ending, isn't it? It's not necessarily entirely happy.
It's authentic.
Yeah, it's mucky in the right way.
It's a good way to put it.
Because it would be stupid if it was all easy, because the whole book is like, it's a mess.
Then they lived happily in peace forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Terry Pratchett's not going to wait and be like, I've solved war. Like, he, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's more work to be done, and Polly intends to do it, but it still needs doing.
Yeah.
Look, that's the end of the plot. And we have sort of barreled through the end part of that, but there's so much that happens in this book. We should get onto some listener questions, but before we do that, are there any favorite lines or jokes or any bits that people want to mention that we haven't mentioned? I mean, there are a lot of it's very funny and there's a lot of good gags. I can see, Freya, you've done the same thing as me. You've got a bunch of tags in your copy of the book. There's so many of them, though.
I even went through and took some out, which was like, because I was like, there's too many in here.
Yeah.
It cracks me up heaps, but I was mostly marking the bits where I was like, gudonk, like something makes sense to me. And that happened a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any particular ones you'd like to call out?
a couple of things. These two bits that are related in my mind. I wonder if they're related in your minds.
Mm-hmm.
When they're talking to Corporal Skelet, three parts, and he reveals that he has eaten the leg of his friend and his friend ate his leg. And they're all very shocked and freaked out. And Tonka goes, but that's cannibalism. And three parts goes, no, it's not. Not officially. Not unless you eat a whole person. Military rules. Which I think is just, it just fucking delighted me. Mm. And then also when they talk about theatre and they're having theatre explained to them, it's sort of similar to how the newspaper is explained, and they're like, it's very abominable, people in a room watching other people. But also when they're talking about a Punch and Judy show that once happened in the town, then they dragged the man away and it became an abomination, and the bit about it that cracked me the fuck up in a gross, upset way was it was an abomination because crocodiles should not be seen to eat figures of authority, apparently. Although until the puppet show, no one in town knew what a crocodile was. The bit where the clown had beaten his wife had also constituted an abomination because he had used a stick thicker than the regulation 1 inch.
Yeah.
Based on truth.
These bits that's like, you think it's, I don't know, you think it's something else, and then it's it's a rough little joke, it goes in the right way. I don't know. Those bits, I put a little marker on them because I was like,
oh yeah.
That was sort of how I laughed.
Yeah.
It is that kind of laugh, yeah.
The laugh. Too real. Oh no.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be thinking about that later when something relatable happens. It's not good. But also it's great.
Yeah.
At the same time.
To lighten the mood there, I think one of my favorite puns in the book, if not the best one, is, you know, they've established this whole thing that the girls use socks to make themselves appear more authentically male. But nobody else necessarily knows about that. There's a great part where Polly says something about socks and Blaz is like, what do you mean he punched you in the socks or whatever? but there's also a bit where Polly refers to it as having a socks change. I thought that was very funny.
Oh, my God.
It was so good.
Goodness.
And I think that's probably my favorite joke in the book. But, yeah, it was pretty great.
Wow.
I also really liked, because it's established that because Paul likes birds so much, Polly's become a bit of an amateur ornithologist. And there's a bit where they're walking through the forest and someone she says, oh, she's heard a bird call. And as an amateur and ornithologist, she recognized it as, or she identified this one as the sound of the very bad bird impersonator. I've got to teach them how to do realistic sounding bird calls. This is ridiculous. I thought that was pretty great too. And so many others.
Mine are also all like, oof, that's like a line that really gets the truth of like some horror of mankind. But I flicked through I also folded down the pages rather than doing tabs because I am a criminal. But one that is actually funny, it was like, he gave her what is known as an old fashioned look. This one had dinosaurs in it.
Yeah, that was great.
Good shit.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite jokes is when they're in the bar near the start and Igor, as they are still going by at that moment, says, this beer tastes of horse pith. And then he says, oh, you know, would you? And he said, yes, I've drunk it before. And then a little bit after that, Maledict says, I don't drink horse piss. And it's like such a good joke on the classic vampire line. I just really enjoyed that. I mean, there's so many good jokes and so many of those off moments. Liz, were there any that you particularly wanted to mention?
No, like the whole book is like just like a gut punch all the way through. Like I've like deliberately leafed past like, because I've like folded down some of the really hard ones. But on your horse piss thing though, like now that we've started on the horse piss, I love that Igor is like comment about the horse piss. catalyzes a whole series of events, which causes like the bartender to bring out the good beer and like to be threatened by the vampire and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And then when offered the choice, Igor's like, I'd like more of the horse piss, please. I wasn't saying it was bad.
Yeah.
I was simply like, offering an opinion.
That was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I said enough heavy things. I won't read my heavy quotes, but I will read them and feel sad.
There were a couple. There are a couple that I think they were heavy, but in a kind of in a good way. Like later on in the book, like when Maledict says, "Well, actually, my name's Maledicta," but Polly's thinking about something else. And then when she catches up, she goes, "Oh no, that's good. You know, you're you, and Tonka's Tonka, and I'm me, whoever I am." And it's this sort of little speech about identity. It's like, yeah, gender's not the important part of your identity. Is basically the point of that little speech that she makes. And I thought that was really lovely. That was a really lovely moment. And then the one that really got me, the one that was maybe really kind of shed a little tear, was when Jackram's saying to Polly, "I'm my own man," and she goes, "Are you Sarge?" Because she's like, "But you don't feel like you can go back to your own son. Like, come on, like you can though." It was really, oh, that one got me too.
I will say one of my very depressing ones that I feel like got that cut really to the core of what it's like, and it's one that happened between Strappy and Polly as Oliver, because it to me summed up the thing where like it's like the famous observation about how like it's men who never have to go to war who send off people they don't know or relate to die on the front lines. And so like it's early on when Strappy's being a bullying little bastard and it says, "Oh good," said Strappy, stepping back, "we'll just see what you're made of, parts flesh," thought Polly, "blood easily cut things, oh well." And, like, that's before they have, like, a funny little fight where, like, she bests Strappy. But, like, to me, that kind of got to the core of what it's about, because, like, Strappy fucks off the moment that things get real, the moment that his life is in danger. But he's very happy to recruit young boys or whoever it is and send them off to the front line, because to them, to him, it's, like, a obscure concept. But, like, his life is what matters. So that battle between the two of them and that quote sort of gets to the core, I think, of, like, we can intellectually, as like this class of politicians, make a decision that war is necessary, but it's not us who's going to go fight it. And that scene sums, and that quote sums it up.
Yeah.
Well,
a random bit that really stuck out to me, I think just in how it's written, not even, it's not even, doesn't even carry any of the huge ideas, but I keep thinking about it. Is how when they're in the zombie caverns, how the Duchess appears. And it's so, it goes, "It was barely brighter than a glowworm, but a single photon can do a lot of work in chthonic darkness." I don't know what that word is. Chthonic. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Means kind of like deep underground.
That, look, it makes complete sense, doesn't it? Those essentially context clues. Anyway, this light, "It rose above the kneeling Wazir until it was woman height, because it was a woman, or at least it was the shadow of a woman. No, Polly saw it. It was the light of a woman, a moving web of lines and highlights in which there came and went, like pictures in a fire, a female shape." I was like, fuck! I was like, fuck, I can see exactly what that is. Oh, that's so visual. And I, and like so, and I really like that about the physical descriptions of people are so often like, just quite cinematic. But I don't know, there's also a few other ones, like there's a bit where someone kind of shrinks in shame. I marked it, I can't find it, but it's something about like each particle of him was saying, "Oh dear," quietly.
Yeah.
This is from the scene where they capture one of the soldiers carrying the mobile Klax tower and he escapes, taking Blouse hostage. "You're just bluffing, mister." "Upon my oath, I am not bluffing, man. I don't think we was ever introduced, by the way. Jackram's the name." The change in the man was a whole body event. He seemed to get smaller, as if every cell had said, "Oh dear," very quietly to itself. He sagged, and Blouse slumped a little. "Can I..." "Too late," said Jackram. Polly never forgot the sound the arrow made.
All of these little bits just... so recognizable in the old mind's eye, but in a way that like you know, that thing where you haven't seen it before, but you have seen it. You haven't seen it described, but you've seen it.
You felt it.
Described so perfectly. I really loved it.
Yeah.
Not that I have seen an apparition of a god or anything, but
no.
If I did, I'd know how to describe it now.
Yeah.
Just,
that was glorious. Yeah. And a nice little bit of a little Pratchettism where he throws in like a few scientific terms in there, even though what he's describing is entirely paranormal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really love that too.
Really cool.
Are you saying ghosts aren't science?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Liz. I'm so sorry. But look, we should get into some listener questions. We've got a whole heap of them. Thank you to everyone who sent them in, and particularly the Discworld Reddit community really came through with a whole bunch of questions. We are not going to have time to get through all of them, but let's see how many we can get through.
So our first question comes from Carly CTF via Reddit. Does Monstrous Regiment have the most overt, darker themes of the Discworld series? It's a big question.
I mean, I'd say it's got to be
yes
up
and no.
There. Yeah. What's yes and what's no for you, Liz?
Wasn't they all have dark themes, but I feel like this one sort of like swims around in them most overtly. So that's the yes. The no is that Terry Pratchett always has dark themes in his books. Pretty much. It's just how close to the surface are they and how much does he indulge, like, the darkest aspects of them? And also, like, what's darker than war in human nature? Like, it's like the worst of all of our things congealed into one horrible thing. So it's like the themes building on themselves to be the worst thing.
Mm.
So I guess I'm like, yes in caps and no in lowercase.
Fair enough. And look, this book comes fairly soon after Nightwatch, which is probably the other one that has the most overt dark themes, although I would say The Amazing Maurice and His Educated Rodents is right up there as well, and the fourth Tiffany Aching book.
For those who haven't read it, Maurice is a cat.
Yeah, but it has some really dark stuff in it. And so does, yeah, that fourth Tiffany Aching book, which is the most recent one we've discussed on the podcast.
Yeah.
With the rough music and all of that. Ooh, yeah.
God.
So I think it's up there. I don't know if I'd say it's the darkest one, but it's certainly in the top three, I reckon.
Our next question comes from Myth by Discord. The depiction of a truly beneficial in both directions dependent relationship, Lofty and Tonker, was equally eye-opening for younger Myth, and I wonder if this ties to deeper themes in the entire book.
Hmm. And we didn't talk much about their relationship, but except for that really strong image of it where they're holding hands and the way Polly describes it. It does feel a bit dependent in both directions, doesn't it?
Well, because they've both been through something pretty awful.
Mm. Yeah, good question.
Like, I don't know if it ties into the deeper themes, but, like, I guess, like, maybe the deeper themes lead to their relationship in some ways. Like, it's hard to sort of, for me anyway, to draw parallels between that and, like, Borgravia and the greater context of, like, the Discworld. But their relationship is beautiful, dependent, stressful and upsetting and born out of something truly horrifying as well. Like, would they have had that relationship to the strength they have had they met in other circumstances? It's impossible to know. I mean, Polly and her brother's relationship, like, yes, she loves her brother, but she's been absolutely parentified. It's not the same thing at all, but, like, it's everyone's relationship is born out of circumstance. Doesn't make the love any less genuine, authentic, real, and wonderful. It's just the context through which it was created. So I don't know if you can draw a parallel between the wars and that, but I think it was a really interesting and nice way to show the ways that people can find each other.
Maybe there's something about solidarity. This regiment is kind of, I don't know, it seems like it's doing something different to the rest of the army in that solidarity and in that protecting each other's, I don't know, is there something in that?
Yeah, I was thinking along those lines. Someone did comment something in one, I was either on Reddit or in Discord, about how there's that inversion where, you know, what the regiment does is they pull together, like they discover each other's secret and then they work together to sort of try and help each other and do something about it, whereas all of the high-ranking officers who were women all thought they were alone, and so instead their response was to become just like the male officers and do all of the horrible things that male officers do, sending out other men to die and so on. And so there's a difference there that, you know, when they have this relationship, there's something there, I think, with Tonka and Lofty is that they've pulled together and so they've become something greater and they help each other out and they've survived. Whereas the girls who didn't find something like that in the working school were like kind of broken by it in one way or another. Like even Wazza is kind of broken by it, although in a way that ends up kind of working out, but still has to go through this horrible thing and feels quite alone until she finds the regiment.
Mm. All right. So next question, and I'm sorry if I'm going to butcher this question, Twant Funkler by Reddit. How long did it take for Borogrovia to fall so spectacularly from a group of disrenowned chocolatiers to a war-torn, starving country?
Yes, because they are mentioned in Thief of Time as where the really nice chocolates come from. And in this one, I think chocolates have been added to the list of abominations. So I feel like that could mean it could happen virtually overnight. Although how they managed to produce and export chocolates when they're in this massive war, I don't know, because they're supposed to be fighting all the time.
And we've talked a lot about the complicated timeline of like the Discworld because of like that's just when you get into Wishes books, there's some skipping over time. We don't know when the patrician like that we know starts. It's so yeah, but I think overnight is a good answer to that. Mm. So
but I do think there would be Borogravian chocolatiers who have left Borogravia, they've like smuggled themselves out and they've gone to Ankh Morpork and now they make chocolates there. And that's how the chocolate industry or tradition of has survived. That's my two cents. I think that's how it's happened.
All right, I'm going to aggressively rocket us through some more questions because we got so many good ones and we're not even going to get through half of them. But okay, so the next one comes from All the Janets via Reddit. Terry's treatment of the Nugganites in Monstrous Regiment feels much more cynical and negative than his treatment of the Omnians in Small Gods. What are your thoughts on that shift?
It's very, very different. We don't really get a good picture of what the organized religion of Nuggan is like. The glimpses that we see are like kind of some of the worst institutions that have come out of the Catholic Church, right? We see the girls' working school. We hear about the priest who's quite clearly abusing the girls in the school and getting away with it and that nobody's doing anything about it. So there's those sort of bits of it that we hear. And then also there's the oppressive nature of the edicts that are handed down and constantly being changed by Nuggan himself and enforced by the priests. But we never really interact with any of the priests or any of the clergy directly. We just hear about how awful they are. But it feels much more modern, whereas, you know, the Church of Om in Small Gods, it's a much more history-based, like not 50 or 70 years ago, more like, you know, hundreds of years ago. Like they're more like the Inquisition, but it's much more a direct commentary on not the belief being the problem, but the institution being the problem. And here it's kind of they're not really separated as much because the things that Nuggan asks you to believe are horrendous and stupid, and that people enforce them is kind of dumb. And then there's also the difference that the Borogravians largely are like, we realize this is dumb, but that's our God and that's what he says, so we kind of have to do it anyway, which is a very different kind of, I don't even know if it's really a critique on religion. Like, I don't think you take it too seriously. I think the stuff that matches real world wrongs that have been perpetrated by some religious institutions, I think that is definitely a commentary on how that happens and people get away with it because they have authority, and because that authority is invested in religion, it's not questioned. But I don't think it's as much of a commentary on the institution or the belief necessarily. So I think it's kind of talking about different things.
All right. So let's have some fun ones now. So this one comes from All the Janets by Reddit. If you were a Discworld vampires, A, would you want to become Black Riveners? And B, if you did, what would be your replacement craving / obsession?
And I do just want to throw in here while we're thinking of answers that more than one person did ask us this. Joel also asked us via Discord. It was a popular question. But yeah, would we want to become Black Riveners and give up drinking blood?
No one wants to become a Black Ribboner. Like ethically, you'd want to be the person who does. Like, you want, that's aspirational, right? It's like how I would want to be the person who wants to be a Black Ribboner, but I feel like as me, I'd probably be like, I'm going to just like suck the blood of like bad people or something. Like, I'd find some way to ethically not be a Black Ribboner. Like, I'd be like, oh, well, I will just like suck the blood of murderers or like people who, what's worse than murderers? That, yeah, there we go. Like, I'd like to be a Black Ribboner, but I probably wouldn't be if I'm true with myself.
How come we're all about girls being themselves, but not vampires being themselves.
Well.
Double standard.
Well, because being a girl doesn't mean, like, literally sucking the life sucking out blood. Of the people around you, you know?
But being I'm sorry, do you know what it's like to be a girl?
You don't know what it's like.
Okay, all right.
I'm sucking blood every day.
Oh, no. Well, I feel like I'm a vegetarian.
This is a good opportunity for me to talk about the mechanics of fangs. So, like, because, like, I've thought about this a lot, and I brought this up a lot at parties as a teenager, which I was invited to very few of, I'm not sure why, but like vampires, like to suck blood, like yes, you could have just like solid fangs where you puncture a vein and then you like try and like suck the blood out, but you'd like leave other fang marks at the edge because your teeth are still there unless they retract, which they don't. So like to actually work, you'd have to have like fangs that are hollow with a hole at the end so that when you puncture into the blood vessel, both of them function like straws, so you can, while they're in there, suck the blood out. And like, yeah, that's the only way it would rationally work to leave the kind of fang marks they have in movies. So there we go. That's not an answer to the question you asked, but that's the question I've been answering that hasn't really been asked for like 20 years. So you're welcome.
So like a snake's fangs, but the poison, it's not poison coming out, it's blood going in is what you're saying.
Look, not all snakes are poisonous, but like, yeah, it's there's straw teeth that have holes and it's mechanically engineered to do well. I would not be a black ribboner and I would probably bore my victims to death with that fact. I'd be like, hey, this is how my fangs work actually. And they'd be like, please just kill me. Just take my blood. I want to die and not hear the rest of this story, please.
Wow.
Please.
Okay.
But the fun part, if you were a black ribboner, what's your replacement craving / obsession? Well, telling people that story. No,
I think I would be a black ribboner. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, would. So I feel like this is the vampire equivalent. So I think I would.
Less
I think I would do it.
Vegetarian take.
What?
I'm like, just laughing at you.
That's fair. but I also think. I think I don't know if I answered this question before, but I think it would be tea. I would drink tea. I would have to drink tea all the time.
Wow. So gentle.
I'd probably get obsessed with something real, like, specific, like crypto or, like, instant scratchies or or, like, Wordle or, like, something really specific. Like, it would have to be, like, something that fully takes my attention. Like, I have to do a cryptic crossword every half hour or I will just go berserk. Like, it's...
I feel like that's where you want to go. I feel like you want to go with something. I wouldn't want to go like Otto and be obsessed with freaking art in any way because that would be torture. Like, whoa, why would you do that to yourself, my guy? Nope.
He like literally implied, like he summed up the art quite well. Like, it's just like it hurts you so much to do it. You have to really
your
love
art
it.
Destroys you every and time.
Then,
yeah.
On, I already am obsessed with it and feel I have to do it or I'll die. And it still doesn't. Oh, God. I don't know. Yeah. When I was thinking about this, I was like, what's a fun addiction? And then I was like, oh, addiction. Oh.
It's not fun, is it?
Oh. As soon as you're addicted,
it's not fun anymore.
Oh,
just, no, it's like, do my cat's cradle or I'll kill you. Like, it's just like...
I had this bee in my bonnet about this because people still use the term addictive or indeed they try to use some weird sort of alternate term and say addicting when they're talking about video games.
Oh, my God, that makes me so angry.
Yeah, I hate that. It's the worst. Mm-mm. It's not a good thing. It's never positive.
I'm so glad, to be honest.
It's the same thing but grammatically strange. Like,
it's just unnecessary. Oh,
I mean, to be clear, I'm not
really
sorry. I'm slightly angry at the word, but I'm more angry at the sentiment. But I agree with you. The word is also maddening. So it's not good. As soon as something becomes an addiction, it is not, by definition, it's not. I should say we had another listener, Grindorphins, who said, sorry, Griffindorphins is the name. It's a good username. I want to get it right. But they respond to this question and said, we're pretty sure the answer for the Pratchatters would be Discworld books and puns. And I think there's something, there's some truth in that, I think.
They know you.
They do.
They see inside.
They got us.
I do feel seen. I did used to be cryptic crosswords, though.
They are good.
That rocks.
Liz, can I throw one in here that we haven't done? But I feel like we had a couple of people ask this as well. One of them was, if we could add an abomination into the big book, what would it be? Like, if we could prohibit people from doing or enjoying or watching or seeing or just prohibit something as a god, what would it be? And a couple of people asked, if we could have an item of clothing or a kind of food named after us, what would it be called? And which one would we prefer?
It says two very different things.
They are.
So much to consider.
I mean, I guess I'd get rid of a large chunk of reality TV. Like, there's a section of it that I really love and there's a section of it I really hate. So I guess it would be like the section of reality TV I don't like, the bit that I like can stay. So
So you'd have to think very carefully about how to define the one that you don't like.
No, I've defined it. It's the ones that I like can stay and the ones that I don't can go.
I don't know what those are. How do you communicate that to me?
It doesn't matter. How. Like, I don't have to communicate it to you. It's fine. What's left?
You just got
to
figure it out.
Yeah.
Getting too real.
Certain series of The Bachelor and Bachelorette, fine. Some, none. No, none of that. Survivor, okay. Amazing Race, definitely. But, like, you know, it's case-by-case basis.
Well, I knew The Amazing Race.
I knew that was in.
That's because The Amazing Race is amazing and I'd fail at it and so I have to watch other people succeeding, so it's good.
Yeah, okay. I think one of my abominations would be the phrase going away, like when people describe like a feature being taken out of a bit of software or a service they're no longer going to provide and they say, this service is going away. I'm like, no, it's not going away. You're choosing to end it. Describe why and take ownership of that choice. It's not going away by itself. I hate that phrase. It's
so funny.
It's one of my irrational hatreds. I really just hate
That's
the way
pretty
that
rational.
Well, it's just such a weasel phrase. It's just a nothing phrase. It just sort of takes. It's such a passive way to say it and take out the responsibility. I just hate it so much.
Should we just abominate euphemisms? Like,
no. Some euphemisms are great. They're fun.
What about just, like, imprecise language?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Vagueness.
You are destroying all our careers, Fran. What are you doing?
the very literal literary books.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
She was sad that man was bad to her. The book is finished.
It's perfect. That's... What's the opposite of abominable?
Delightful?
Huh.
Don't know.
You guys got that straight away.
Well, we were both a bit doubtful about it, though, so I'm not sure if it's the right.
There's a question mark at the end. We both said the same thing. We spent a lot of time together. But you both,
the fact that you both said it made me, I just, that's the truth now.
Okay. It's wikiality
at
work.
What happens to me. God. Yeah.
What about if you were going to have something named after you, would you prefer to have an item of clothing or some kind of food? And what would it
be? Food.
Food. You were very quick off the mark with that.
Clothing.
Would you go clothing? Okay. Why clothing?
And what kind of clothing?
I didn't say what kind of clothing. But like, I just feel like an Elizabeth food does not sound appetizing.
An Elizabeth.
Yeah, I just feel like people are like, oh, I've served Elizabeth for dinner and it does.
I think it sounds more like a dessert and it sounds a little bit.
It sounds like it comes with a ruffle and I just.
They do. It was more last names.
Would people want to eat a flux? Like, I don't really feel like that's like something you want served up on a plate and like. Yeah.
Okay. You can't make the name flux not sound cool, unfortunately. It's always going to be cool.
Yeah. So maybe it's a clothing item.
I would happily eat a flux and I would also wear the shit out of the flux.
Okay, well, that's delightful. The extreme opposite of abomination and makes me not sure which one to choose now, but I feel fine with either way.
I feel like a flux as a piece of clothing would be some sort of weird jumper. I'm thinking of like sort of like a weird, like a bolero jacket kind of thing that's like not a full length. But it's also flexible and you can wear it in different ways. I don't know why. That's just what came into my head. Because
Like it, but you're getting an Elizabethan rough. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's fine. Ray, what, you said food, and you were very clear that that's what you prefer. What kind of food? Like, you don't have to be specific, but do you mean, would it be like a dessert
was,
or?
Yeah, I don't know. Food, it was very easy to answer that it would be food and not clothes, but beyond that, very unsure. Mm. Obviously, it should be delicious.
Mm-hmm. Would it be called a sad grove?
What time of day does it suit?
I just had a feeling it might be a bit meaty, which I'm sorry, Ben.
No, that's okay.
Vegetarian.
I don't have to eat it.
Breakfast, okay.
I just feel like, I don't know, it could be like a bear steak.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I feel like, that's what I got.
Okay.
Just a bear.
Wait, do you mean a steak with nothing on it, or do you mean a steak made out of a bear?
Oh, my God. I meant a bear like a B-A-R-E. But, I mean, there's so many options now. The world's opening up.
It doesn't
Maybe it is
sauce.
A steak of an animal that we don't normally eat. Mm. That would be better because then it would have to be kind of invented as a dish.
Mm.
Okay. Something that doesn't already exist.
I reckon I could go either way with this. I could go food or clothing. It would be called a Mackenzie. Mm-hmm. I feel like there probably already is some sort of clothing called a Mackenzie. Like, there's so many people
called it. And it's
Mackenzie.
Definitely a tie.
Yeah, it feels like it's something toffee, doesn't it? Like a tie or
no, it's the way you tie a tie.
Oh, it's a knot. It's a kind of tie knot. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, I could see that. I don't know that I prefer that now. So now I want to say I would like to be food, but I would like it to be a breakfast food. And I would like it to involve eggs and mushrooms. In fact,
that sounds right. Yeah.
You know, there's like different names for like Eggs Benedict.
Eggs McKenzie.
Yeah.
Eggs McKenzie has a gorgeous ring to it.
Yeah, I like that. And it could be an Eggs Benedict with a
portobello mushroom.
But yeah, with a portobello mushroom instead of ham. Like, there's no meat involved. Yeah, I'd be happy with
delightful.
That. That's pretty great.
I mean, you've actually created a meal, whereas like
Eggs McKenzie.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. I'm really happy with that.
Now.
Also, now my nickname is going to be Eggs, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm sorry, but it's going to be.
Yeah, damn it. I walked in.
That's right. A delightful nickname.
Yeah, and also a delightful dish. So I really want steak. Okay, so I'm not quite sure how to say this because there's two fives, so I'm going to say them as S's. From Base of Ort via Reddit, what would be your ideal scubbo recipe?
Ooh. And we decided this was kind of like homeopathy, right? It's like a really thin soup with just a touch of whatever you can get in it. So what would be the thing you'd hope you could get to put in it?
Isn't it just like when you like clear out your fridge and you make a meal in water, but like with the things you have?
Yeah, but what would you ideally hope that you had in order to make it? Like, what would you find in the dregs of your fridge that would make you go, oh, yes, excellent, this is going to make a great scubbo?
A lapchang.
A lapchang?
You won't like it as meat, but it's like a dried Chinese sausage that you get. You don't even have to keep it in the fridge, but it's like real fatty. You often like just put it in the rice while you're cooking it. It flavors the rice around it. It is delicious. You should only eat one. So I always eat one and a half. It's great. And it flavors everything around it. You don't have to add salt. Yeah. It's got fat in it. It's just beautiful. So
okay,
that's what I'd want in the scubbo.
I'll pay that.
Amazing. Yeah. Just want a stock cube.
Yeah.
Probably.
There you go.
Be great to have a stock cube.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been converted to the wonders of MSG by my partner.
Oh, true.
Who has started using it and now we can never go back. So I feel like that would be the thing. I think whole armies would have marched much more upright and excitable if they just had like a packet of MSG and they could just add a little pinch to whatever. Just, really good. But actually, I also think maybe Vegemite. Like a little bit of Vegemite goes a long
disgusting.
Way.
Ugh, Australians.
I earned that.
Was your motivation, though, like to have a delicious time or for your army to march? Because if your army is to march, then you'd want to have like how did they first find out about like dexamphetamine? Was like they gave that guy like a bunch of them and he skied for like 7 days straight? Like, it depends on what your end goal is.
Well, I mean, that's the most effective scubbo recipe maybe, but I don't know if it's my favorite.
just as ideal Scubbo recipe. So I guess it depends on what your end goal is. And my end goal was to have a delicious time, not for my army to be like, and now we're going on to like be an army.
I think my goal's the same.
Okay. All right. I'm going to stop taking this to a weird place. I'm going to go to our final question, which comes from infamous brackets Lloyd Owens via email. What other hallucinations might a Discworld vampire project in extremis?
Oh, yeah. So Maledict goes to a sort of weird place of basically American Vietnam movies like Platoon and Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket. And also, this was Lloyd sent this in and it just had some great suggestions, like maybe Otto would channel like Robert Mapplethorpe's art or some photojournalism. And I thought that was a great suggestion.
Picks of Spider-Man. No.
Yeah.
That's one of the suggestions. Yeah. I'm not just saying that.
That was great. But, yeah, what else could you hallucinate? Let's go with the same vibe. Like, if you're in a war, you hallucinate round world war movies of a particular kind. So maybe if you're in Ankh-Morpork in this bustling metropolis and you're a black ribboner, but you can't get whatever it is, like run out of tea or crosswords or whatever, what do you start hallucinating?
I've got it, and it is the entirety of Casablanca, except it's starring Nobby.
Okay. That's very specific and weird. I like it a lot.
And you had it right there.
Yeah, it was ready to go.
It was ready.
It was amazing. I think the one I'm imagining would be video game related. I think Ankh-Morpork would start to look like it was made in Minecraft. That's what I reckon. Yeah. That'd be a good weird one, particularly if, you know, your obsession was like something game related.
I don't know if I have an answer to it because I'm a little bit confused by how the hallucinations work.
It did feel a bit like just an excuse to put some Vietnam War stuff in there that wouldn't have fit otherwise, you know?
Yeah. I think it's a sick convention. I really like it. Contagious hallucination.
Yeah.
That's so cool. But I don't know what the parameters are.
We need the mechanics of it.
How wide do these go?
Yeah. I did like the way it was justified by them sort of talking about the reason vampires have such acute senses is that their kind of sense of self doesn't just contain itself within their body but extends to like a radius around them. And that kind of – and I don't know if they drew the direct line between that and the contagious hallucinations, but that was already in the book, I think, was mentioned earlier. And then it was like, okay, well, that sort of makes sense that, you know, their hallucinations would leak out into that sense of self.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
I will just say real quick that Casablanca is not available on streaming anywhere in Australia. So put aside the five people who have it on DVD and VHS, like maybe it is a contagious hallucination.
Oh, maybe it is.
It could be the start of a beautiful contagious hallucination.
I don't think we can top that as a place to sort of end our discussion. So I feel like this kind of brings us to the end. Thank you to everyone who sent in a question. I'm sorry we couldn't get through all of them. We had so many good ones. We might try and find a way to answer a few more. We'll see how we go. But Freya, thank you so much for joining us to discuss this book.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to have some nerdy chat.
Yeah. If people have been wonderfully entertained by your wit and insight, which I think they should be, you know, I think
it's okay if they're not.
I think they will. I think
they definitely have. And if they want to find you more, like, how do they do that?
Yeah.
You could visit my website. Hopefully it will be back up and running by the time this episode comes out because it got cancelled because I didn't have a job over the summer.
Oh, no.
But any second now, freyadailysage.com will be back up and running. And I put my shows and various bits and bobs and poems and whatnot on there. I also have a book.
Yes. Head Girl is the name of the book.
That is the name of the book, which came out in 2020, but it's still around. It's poems. Yeah.
And, of course, we'll have a link to that book and all Freya's other links in the episode notes. That really is it. Thank you, Freya, once again. Thank you, Liz, who also can't be here as I do this outro because, unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties at the end of our very long recording session for this episode. We had to cut out an awful lot of stuff. Some of that will be bonus bits that we'll be releasing to our subscribers. So if you subscribe to us over on Ko-fi, you'll be able to access some of those in the near future, including a lovely bit where we talked about Wazza and Joan of Arc, which then turned out to be a question in the questions, which we didn't even realize. Anyway, those will be going up as bonus bits. If you'd like to access some bonus bits, it's one of the things we do for those who support the podcast. We are a small independent podcast. We've been going for 7 years, and it's only possible because listeners like you chip in a little bit every month. So if you'd like to support Pratchett, that's one of the main ways you can do it. Another way you can do it, of course, for free, just tell other people about the show. The more listeners we have, the more likely some of them will become subscribers, and the more we will be sustainable until we get to every single Terry Pratchett book and lots of the short stories, which, by the way, is what we're going to be reading next month. Not one short story, in fact, but two. We're going with the theme of animal stories, and we have a great guest, Laura Jean McKay, Australian author of The Animals in That Country. That's the novel, The Animals in That Country, not the collection by Margaret Atwood. We are not having Margaret Atwood as a guest on the podcast. I mean, she might be a great guest, Margaret, if you're listening and you'd like to be a guest, but we won't be having her. No, we're having Laura Jean McKay, and we will be talking about two of Pratchett's animal-themed short stories. One is Hollywood Chickens, which, as the name suggests, is about chickens in Hollywood. That can be found in the collection A Blink of the Screen. And we'll also be reading and discussing From the Horse's Mouth, which is from the newest collection of Terry Pratchett's short stories, A Stroke of the Pen. Although you can also find an earlier form of the story titled Jono the Talking Horse in The Time-Traveling Caveman and Other Stories. Or if you're lucky enough to have a very fancy limited edition of The Witch's Vacuum Cleaner, I think it's in that one as well. As usual, we'll be answering your questions. So if you have any questions about those two short stories, or I guess if you want to throw in a general question about Pratchett's short stories or Pratchett's writing about animals, those would also be great appropriate questions for this particular episode. You can send them to us over social media using the hashtag Pratchett77, or you can shoot us an email. That's chat@pratchettpodcast.com. Which reminds me, by the way, if you are a subscriber, and particularly if you're a subscriber at the Eek tier, it's nearly time for our yearly Eek Club special episode. That's right. Every glorious 25th of May, we make an episode where our Eek tier subscribers choose the things we're going to talk about. So if that's you, it's time for you to send those in. We'd really like you to do that by the end of April, so we've got time to organize some great answers and record that bonus episode just for you. Well, not just for you. That one we share with everyone. Don't forget, it's now officially announced that we will be guests for the Australian Discworld Convention, which is happening in Adelaide in July. So if you want to know more about that, head over to ausdwcon.org to find out how you can get tickets. And maybe we'll see you there. We're not 100% sure what we're doing yet, but there's some other great guests who will be there as well, including previous Pratchett guest Tansy Rayner-Roberts, who was on our last live episode we did at the previous Australian Discworld Convention. So we're cooking up some plans, nothing we can announce yet, but it should be a lot of fun. So hopefully we'll see some of you there. We always love to meet our listeners when we can. But that's it for now. Thank you for your patience, as this episode's taken a bit longer to make than normal. But we really appreciate you sticking with us. And until next time, remember, the real monster was patriarchy all along. You've been listening to Pratchett, the monthly Terry Pratchett Book Club podcast with Pratchetters Elizabeth Flux, Ben McKenzie, that's me, and guest Freya Daly Sadgrove. Pratchett is produced and edited by me on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Our music is by David Ashton. You can find us on social media as Pratchett or Pratchett Podcast, and you can listen to past episodes and support the production of new ones via PratchettPodcast.com. Join the conversation for this episode using the hashtag Pratchett76.
Pratchett is brought to you by Splendid Chaps Productions. We make entertainment for your ears, like the Doctor Who podcast Splendid Chaps and time travel comedy series Night Terrors. To find out more, visit SplendidChaps.com.